Good.
Good to see everyone.
How are you, Danny? I see your happy face, but I can't hear you. Danny's muted right now.
I'm good, thank you.
Good. How are you on the East Coast? Everybody surviving out there?
Yeah, hunkering down like everybody else.
I guess so. Mirabal is still shut down until, looks like they're opening, shooting for August 1st.
Oh, wow.
Coming up with their protocols, but I'm not going to go there until August 15th at earliest, and then limitedly, so we'll see what happens if people are even interested in spas anymore, you know, kind of thing, integrated wellness. But I've done almost 200 phone sessions for a person who didn't do on the phone to have gone from zero to probably almost 200 phone sessions since March 22nd is a little bit of a shift. The good news is that you can learn to scan holographically at distance and it'll work just fine. You know, I just worked with just certified our 60th trainee, who is a psychiatrist, who is, there she is, Miss Carrie is here now. Yay, congratulations, woo-hoo! Carrie, our 60th certified practitioner. Nice. That's not really very many for how long we've been doing this, but we're getting up there, you know. You have to work at it. Carrie came in and did her work here and worked with me. It was good. Very nice. Congratulations.
Did you get your certificate, Carrie?
She did. She got it in person. She was here. Carrie flew in. So one thing you need to know for people, clients that are able to drive in, I can do intensive work with you for the next few months. Carrie graciously found a lovely condo that is a 4-minute walk from my office here, an Airbnb. So if you can drive into Tucson, you can actually bring your own food, bring your own thing, never see another human being except myself, and keep everything very safe and secure. So we do have a few options for secure, you know, it's more than social distancing. We'd be like almost quarantining ourselves. I don't go out very much. I don't expose myself to anybody else. I don't want to give anything to clients. And those of you that have done phone sessions with me, we've kept this thing rolling pretty well. But Carrie came in and got certified. So that was great. Yay. And there are advantages to the in-person piece. The energy part is helpful. Carrie and I were just talking about the fact that she was taught way back when and to project the client in front of you and then shrink them down to the size of a toddler in front of you so you can scan the whole system. And you actually get a remarkable amount of detail. Once you're not limited by your five senses, you move into your sixth or seventh senses, whatever those other details are, and you get through the body and movements and connections in the body and across the system. You get a lot of information coming from the client if they are actually holographically in front of you. It is a real deal. The first time I scanned the first client, I was nauseated, you know, felt the concussion memory like I told some of you, and was shocked that it was as vivid as if I was physically there with the client. Only the physical body wasn't there to distract me, you know, when I did it long distance. So you can holographically picture the client. Some of you just do it mentally. I think Carrie does it across the room. I don't know if you even use your hands to holographically scan the toddler or, you know, size person, but we can do that. I like doing that and getting the data because I'm like, oh, wow, you're being really tight, hard on yourself with your responsibility issues in your right neck and shoulder. And we'll go into detail about that. I'm like, wow, that's connecting to your stomach. Now I'm feeling nauseated. One of the things that's happening much faster for me with the long distance is the link between the beginning of the scan and my stomach. So immediately I'm like, wow, I'm feeling a little queasy. Have you had some nausea lately? Or is there some kind of vertigo or dizziness going on? Or do we need to work on your concussion memories? So you'll get detail about that. There's no reason why you can't do this long distance. I think for physical ailments, for viral things, it's helpful to have a proximity to the actual frequency. There's something about that. I like the additional data, and I like the fact that I can feel, I can't quite feel that you heating up at a distance when you're releasing. Whereas I can feel that if I'm in contact with the body, I can feel all the thermal changes. And I like that piece. So I encourage you to learn both. Learn to do it contact in your coaching and your shamanic practices and your energy work. But if you're a physician and you're not supposed to be, well, physicians can touch. If you're in a position as a therapist, you're not supposed to touch, you're only supposed to talk, you know, the other way around, if you're only supposed to talk and not supposed to touch it. So work with that and see what you can do. You can do it proximate to the body. I think Carrie is the first person that's been certified that's not been able to lay a hand on a client during her training certification. you know, with COVID. She did the whole thing, I think. Did you have any physical contact with clients? I don't know if you did any.
No, the only contact. One was you.
Okay. The final exam. That's kind of weird, isn't it? So you can truly say HMR does not require the physical contact at C7. It has always been an optional point for access. And but there's no reason we cannot learn to do this long distance and be able to scan holographically. So it really is becoming holographic memory resolution when you're scanning a therapeutic hologram in front of you. But with the intention and permission, we have access to the system. Do ask for permission and gain access when you do that. So welcome, everybody. Brent, I think we're still assembling.
Brent, how is that Zoom system working for you? Is it completely confidential? And what does it cost? Is it working well for you if you've done 200 sessions?
Well, I do mostly by phone. I like phone. And if the phone is clear, I'll do phone. But I have a client in London and a couple of clients on the East Coast that have bad phone reception in the mountains or from London. Even London, the Zoom connection, the internet connection can fade in and out even with Zoom. But I do like the clarity of the voice and having the person visually in front of me with Zoom. I'm not sure it's the most secure lines for doing therapy, but I don't know what alternatives we have to set up that people would have access to, is the way it comes down. But Zoom has worked really well thus far, certainly better than Skype. For the clients I've done Zoom with, it's worked just fine.
Brent, I can answer Scott's question. On July 20th, I believe is the date, they are going to switch to an encryption level that if you use a password, in other words, if you set up a meeting and your client has to put in a password, that encryption level is probably as high as any other online meeting tool that you can find. They're upping their encryption level on July 20th, I believe. But you have to choose that. In other words, you have to, when you set up your meeting, you'll see it as an option to do that level of encryption, and they're required to use a password if you choose to do that, which means you get the higher, and you do have to pay for it. And I don't know what the cost is, Scott. I can find it for you.
I just was curious about the quality and whatever. So that's good to know that they're going to be more secure July 20th. I have a website through therapysites.com, and they offer a secure a video system for $40 a month. And I don't know what you probably can get that without a website. I know that it seems to be secure. I haven't ordered it yet, but it's supposed to be HIPAA compliant, like their email system that they have with our websites.
All right, if they're telling you it's HIPAA compliant, they're using. It just went right out of my brain, but it's a level of encryption that is a secure. The only other encryption that's probably higher than that would be what the government uses, what, you know, the military uses. So,
right.
Now that's probably the highest you're going to get in business. If they're saying they're HIPAA compliant, that's pretty encrypted.
So Scott, what's the name of that company? Therapy Services? Is that it? Or what's it?
It's called Therapy Sites. Okay. All one word, you know, therapy, SITES.com. And they offer websites, but I think you can get their secure email. I get it for $15 a month on top of the website cost. And then the HIPAA compliant video conferencing is $40 a month, or $50 if you want to be able to sign paperwork on their system. So they charge an extra $10 if you want to have clients actually signing things, you know, while you're online with them with a video.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Thanks for that information.
So one of the things Hey, Brent, Bill here.
Hi, Bill.
Hey, one of the things that I've found with, if I'm using Skype or even Messenger or video, if the connection's bad or not so great, sometimes it'll cut out for a little bit and you'll miss words.
Comes back and you miss words, right.
I just call in by phone and have the phone on and the audio in the computer, if I'm using the computer, have the audio on the computer off. So even if their picture freezes up, we can still be talking. And so that works pretty well when other things don't.
I've had less trouble with Zoom than I have with the phone. Some people's phones get very garbled and their coverage is not great in the mountains. I got a lot of clients from the East Coast right now. So we're calculating 3-hour time differences and doing things, but there's phones of high quality and there are phones that are not great. So
that's true too.
You're going to have to work with it either way. So I think we're all fudging to try to get this all done at this point, but I haven't had any security problems that I know of or anybody tapping into anything with that. But I miss Aaron. Welcome. Glad that you're here. I see Aaron is here and Miss Karen is here. Great. Both Karens are here. Karen in Vietnam, Karen in Louisiana, which is almost the same as Vietnam. I'm just kidding. You know, you're both in swamps and jungles. What can I say with alligators and critters running around? So hi, Miss Julie. Glad you're here. Glad you made it. And there's phone 97. That's Scott. I didn't recognize you, Scott. Meyer, you here? I see like your name is here.
I am here.
Oh, good. Cool. How's Toronto treating you okay?
Toronto's very hot, humid, terrible.
Sounds like Arizona. Well, we're not hot. We're hot. We're not humid. We got 108 degrees yesterday. But Carrie survived all that. So it's like, okay, I said, you're not going to perspire while you're here. Stay calm. You just walk out in the air and it all evaporates off your skin instantly. There's no humidity. The fires seem to be coming under control, so we're a little bit better. So I really don't have an agenda for today. I did Miraval Zoom this morning, and that was the first protocols that we're putting into place to be able to go back to work there somewhere. I'm going back around mid-August, I think, probably. They're starting around the 1st of August, they think. But they've kept rolling it back a month after a month after a month, so you never know about that. I will keep a phone practice. I've decided to go ahead and keep that component, because there are people that just can't afford the travel and are frightened of planes and all other things. And the phone piece is working well for some individuals. So anyway, questions, issues that you want to discuss that have been coming up for you, cases? We have a lot of people here today. It's great.
Brent, I've got a question. If you get a client whose entire childhood is blocked out and repressed so that they really don't remember anything about their relationship to their parents or their childhood other than maybe their friends or their school, so that their most important relationships are completely blocked out. It obviously tells us that that it was very negative and the whole thing needed to be blocked out for the client's benefit, but how do you proceed with that? I use my own methods, but I wonder, do you just start processing their traumas, or do you tread very, very cautiously, you know, because you don't really know what's below the surface, why it was repressed, and how intense the traumas might be?
Well, yes, you know, grounding and safety. Level 3, we talk about stabilization, safety, grounding as a prerequisite to being able to do effective trauma work. So you're going to want to enhance safety for your client before they begin. I know you use the circular breathing. Some people use colors. Do a little research and find out how they are grounding and how they're creating enhanced safety. If the bottom line is, if the subconscious mind, for whatever reason, does not have an agreement or an alliance for safety, it's not going to give consent to access memory. Now, the interesting part is there are times when amnesia is based on a single head trauma or a single impact. I had a client, I did 2 sessions with her, and she came in and said, thank you so much. She said, I can now go back to my first birthday party and remember the presents or the gifts that they brought. And I'm like, I can't even do that for it. I don't remember much before 5 years old. But she said, yeah, that apparently when the traumatic amnesia sets in, it blocks certain memories. As it creates the block, it blocks all the good memories along with the bad memories, and they'll forget their childhood, their teacher's names. You can check and see if there's a particular age at which the memory block seems to appear, like when I was 8. Did anything happen when you were 8? Now, a couple of things about memory recall. One time, in many cases, actually, I've seen something traumatic happened. They moved or changed location, or they left Italy, moved to the United States when they were 8 or 9. And, you know, to anchor memory and images and locations and buildings and people and houses requires 50, 52 repetitions minimally for linguistic kind of imprinting in the subconscious. And if they don't continuously see those houses and places or notice them and have them reinforced, I have a general impression that they begin, those memories begin dropping into the unconscious, into like repression and forgotten. Also, if it's painful to leave all your relatives and family behind in Europe and to move away, they just start blocking the agony of the move and the pain, and they pick up where they move to. Now, if they're military brats, pardon English, you know, if they're military children and they're moving every 2 years, they have moving trauma. And so they actually begin not bonding and stop connecting to people. So they're not imprinting visual memory. And sometimes, I think, sometimes there weren't enough positive anchors for the memories, the positive memories, to really be reinforced efficiently to be held. So there can be many things that we discussed about the repression of memory. Now, a single blow to the head of a significant nature can cause a block after at a certain age. So you have to check and see if there might be, did you have a body, this ridiculous thing is, did you have any head injuries or traumas to your head? The other piece that comes in is access to memory often is related to emotional. Access to color is related to emotional safety, but I think access to memory is often also related to the development of emotional safety. If they're not safe, a lot of it is going to be shoved into the subconscious. There's a whole discussion we can have about this, that certain parts could contain certain groups of memories and those parts may not be accessible. So you're talking about a kind of dissociation when they don't have memory access. And you're absolutely right. I would not go forward. You can't, if they can't access it, you can't reframe it. But the interesting part is, like Bessel van der Kolk's book says, the body always remembers. So if you want to know how to gain access, one of the things I've done with HMR is once the client has created some level of calm or safety, and see if they can move color through any part of the body. If they can, you can establish safety. If it was very violent and seriously compromised, they're not going to have access to certain memories, certain ages. They're going to have difficulty moving color through any part of the body or sound or feeling. Just because they can't move color doesn't mean there's an amnesia block. It might be a visual trauma of some sort. But if they can move no color, feeling, sound, or sensation through their body in 3 to 5 successive sessions, you have a significant degree of dissociation. And at that point, you can say, I did it this week with a client. She was having trouble imagining color moving through her body. I said, can you move your body in front of you and tell me what the distance is before you can move a color through the body? And she gave me the distance. She says, yeah, it's just kind of in front of me, but it's a little bit away. And I was wondering, because she's like, I'm not sure how effective HMR is with me. And I'm like, you know, you're both having trouble accessing it in your body and picture. She says, I have difficulty picturing moving color through my body sometimes. She could do it on occasion, but sometimes I'm having trouble. So I said, you're going to get better at this because you have some access. But if you have to put your body in front of you, what is the distance? It's kind of strange to say, but some people live their lives about a foot away from their bodies, and the body is the repository of the somatic memory. They live in a kind of numbed out, you know, depressed state. Now, some of the things, Scott, you're describing about people not having access to their childhood memories, sometimes I think the family seem to be like not affectionate, not very loving, not very expressive. It was kind of just kind of basic needs, material needs are met, sometimes wealthy, had nannies, had babysitters, had people around, but there's no really strong nurturing figures anywhere in sight. So I think sometimes they're not imprinting because there aren't enough positive reinforcements for them to anchor the memories to. Now, like I said, the people I've noticed, now there's another phenomenon too I'll have you look at, and I'm not sure about this, but I've seen it about 25 times, maybe 30 times, is people with ADD in early childhood that are kind of spinning, you know, in their processing, cyclical processing, dyslexia, ADD, I don't think they're anchoring in linear memory like many of us do. I don't think they're storing memory in the same manner. It's different. And sometimes it doesn't seem to even be there. It's like, yeah, I spent my childhood running around in circles. I don't remember very much about what happened. And I'm like, okay, that's interesting. And if I'd only seen it once or twice, but I haven't, I've seen it like 20, 30 times. Like, yeah, well, and eventually when I listen to their language, I'm like, has anybody ever assessed you for any learning issues? Oh, they said I might be ADD when I was growing up. I'm like, okay, there's almost like a speed processing thing that doesn't maybe give memory time to anchor. I don't know how else to phrase it. I'm not a neurologist. I can't describe what's happening. We need Mary Getty here. I don't think Mary's here today. But to talk about what might be impacting memory storage from the ADD perspective, that would be quite interesting. I think there is a correlation. So one thing, Scott, to check for is check the learning issues. I do find that I've commonly, you know, a lot of the ADD clients will present that way, then they'll say, and I don't remember much about my childhood, or I have trouble bringing things up. And so I think, and of course, there's the discussion came in 3 decades ago with Dr. Tanaka, how much of learning disability could be trauma-based? Is it really, we don't know where some of this comes from, but some of it, some childhood, some hyperactivity in children is not hyperactivity. It's childhood depression that's manifesting as hypervigilance, running around, anxiety, when's daddy gonna get drunk and hit me again? When is he gonna hurt my sister in the bedroom? When is he gonna, you know, scream at mommy or hit her? And they're on guard. They are hypervigilant and running around and they're depressed. Depression can manifest as hypervigilance in children. And so when you see these alcoholic families where there's a lot of fighting or violence, your child may not be, might not be hyperactive at all, might really be depressed. Don Hoppe in Baton Rouge used to talk about that in his trainings in psychopathology, that some childhood depression manifests as a kind of a hypervigilance or hyperactivity. So they could be running around. And I do find, however, that spinning phenomenon, I just probably 30% of the clients that I eventually identify with ADD and then are confirmed. And I do send them to brain, you know, that there's a resolution for that nowadays. Brain integration technique can resolve dyslexia. And they also work with hyperactivity and different processing issues. But brain integration technique out of Boulder, Colorado, she has a new website. I don't think it's called crossanology.com anymore. I think she's changed the name. But I have somebody going down there now, actually. But BIT, brain integration technique. I have a client doing it in Chicago with a BIT practitioner right now. So we've canceled our sessions because it was clear that in trying to do reframing with her, she was kind of, every time she was doing this, I call it spiraling, kind of tangential processing. When you try to get a linear answer from an ADD or a hyperactive ADD person with processing issues, they're going to circle around the answer and it's going to take 3 times longer to get the answer. And so because they're cyclically processing from that right brain, probably right brain trauma, they're in, you know, operating the B becomes a D, becomes a B, becomes a D in dyslexia. Well, when they're cyclically processing like that, they're not going to give you linear answers. And before I could even reframe issues, in fact, with a typical classic and a really obvious ADD client, you will not be able to slow her down for the first 20 minutes to find out what memory you're supposed to even start working on. They're going to start telling you one issue and giving you another history issue, and they tell you what's been going on, and they got distracted by something, and something else came up, and you're like just trying to get them to process and slow it down a little bit so you could even begin the technique. And there were different techniques. Scott, I think you found some. I think you work with ADD and ADHD too, don't you?
Yes, I usually just ignore it and start working as long as they can process, because I assume that if the system has reverted to ADHD, it's most likely
is in response to some kind of trauma, even if it's a prenatal high stress. So I just proceed as long as we can process.
Okay, and you're talking about using HMR with the client?
Yeah, okay. or whatever else. As long as I can keep moving forward, I don't bother worrying about it. But if they truly can't focus at all, and I had a couple, I teach them breathing, but then a couple of them were able to put on meditation tapes or certain kinds of music, and they would breathe with their body and use their mind to focus on what they were hearing. And it only took about a week or two, and both of them were absolutely normal with the ADHD just by relaxing the body with breathing and distracting the mind enough to allow the body to reach a state of calm. And then they didn't even need it. Their ADHD was normal after that.
Okay. Yeah, that's what they're doing in inpatient. They're keeping the hands occupied with Play-Doh or some object. And then as the body focuses through the breathing or something somatic, then it appears that you gain access to the information and you can process more normally. So that's interesting. There was something else about that was coming to mind, but whether it's breathing. Oh, I was going to tell you also, we have a case where Dave Ebel, I think Ebel, you pronounce it Ebel, and is a physical therapist in Oregon and is a very busy practice. And he worked with a two-year-old who was diagnosed. She was virtually, from his descriptions, they were diagnosing her with a terminal level of rheumatoid arthritis of RA. And he put the child on the mother. She was lying down on the physical therapy table, placed the child on the mother, and I asked him to write up the case. So when I get the write-up, I will share that with you in this supervision. And for those of you in the professional kind of supervision group, we can do that as well. But he placed it on the mother, and he did the HMR on the mother for what she was feeling in her body and the memories that came up. Now, a lot of them involved the child, obviously. And when he finished reframing the memories, the child basically walked out of the office singing, and her RA diagnosis is gone. She is not diagnosed as terminal at this point. And he did, like, I think one or two sessions. And then he tried to explain it to the diagnosing physician, the rheumatologist, and the doctor said, I don't believe this or get it, but obviously her symptoms are gone. She has the pre and post tests available, which for our research might be extremely important. But he said, well, I'm just gonna have the mother hold the child. The child's not very articulate at two, but the mother can speak on behalf of what she feels. And I think he did the HMR through the mother's kind of as a surrogate, kind of a connection to the child. And the mother felt the pain, reframed and they were all experiencing the same thing, violent, alcoholic family member, father, creating the child. And basically the child was like, I'm checking out, I'm leaving. This is too violent, too crazy, unless something shifts. So he worked with the mother, worked with the child, then worked some with the father, communicated, and the child is not showing any symptoms of RA at this point. And so pretty shocking, kind of amazing, but it offers options for I said the advantage of HMR being an alpha theta state is we can access prenatal incarnational memories. I've had three cases. I'm a light, I'm descending, I'm going into this woman. Oh my God, she's not stable. I don't want to go down here. It's too late, I'm already committed. And she reframed, there have been three memories where we reframed descent, but they described as a descent into the mother. And, we're able to articulate. The good news is if you keep the client, this whole thing about depth hypnosis and they're in a pre-verbal state so they can't articulate. The hallmark of HMR is it's a very delicate alpha-theta brainwave state. Conscious mind drops to alpha, but does not go to sleep into a hypnagogic, too strong a hypnagogic state. If you do, we as facilitators pull the client back into the adult. How do you feel about him doing that to you when you're so little? Or about that happening to your mother when you're in the womb. Talk to the adult, bring the adult back into the room. If we can maintain the alpha theta state between the adult, and the alpha and the subconscious coming up to meet it in theta, we can transmit the correction across the bridge, the affective bridge. And at that point, if you can, the child can use the vocabulary of the adult. In this case, the mother, I think, was articulating on behalf of the somatics in the child, and it worked. So that may be a whole other option that we have. Of course, he's a physical therapist, so he has a massage table for them to lie on and things of that sort. But I think a mother could hold the child in her arms and probably accomplish many of the same things here. So I'm curious. I asked him to write up that case and share it with us so we can see exactly how that took place.
I've had a couple of my clients with young children, and I suggested to them that when the child gets disturbed, that the client puts their hand on the C7, mm-hmm. and calms them down and soothes them. And once they've calmed down, to ask them what color they'd like to put through their body. And mm-hmm. the two or three parents that have tried it have said that it works well. I got that idea from you, obviously, but they have said that their kids start to use it without the parent. Once they learn it, kids start to use the color.
Yeah, they're doing it a lot, actually. The children love the color piece. In fact, some come back to me, like, can we go see the color dude, the color therapist, you know? I want to go ask him about more colors. They want to admit they want therapy, but they're like, I want to go see the color guy and see what's happening with that and talk about colors. They are, pardon my English, folks, nothing offensive, but they're not as dense as we are. They are a lot lighter, usually less traumatized and less dense, which means they have much faster access to color frequency and brainwave frequency than we do. You put your hand on C7, I've already told most of you, at least a third of you in previous supervisions, but I placed my hand on a 14-year-old who had seen eight other therapists, was not enthused about being there staring at her fingernails. When I put my hands on C7, her eyes did just go into rapid eye movement. She almost went into rapid facial movement. And she got her proof that something was happening because they feel energy. And the closer, you don't even have to touch it, the closer I got to C7, the faster her eyes got to where literally they were doing this. They weren't rapid eye movement like this. This was like rapid eyelid movement. Everything was going. And I said, I'm sorry, but did you witness something really violent? I just bypassed the protocol. She says, yes, I did. I said, was that recent? In the past year, what happened? My brother got on drugs and he got addicted and he got high one day and he pulled a gun and put it to my head. And then her eyes are going like this at this point. I'm like, okay. And you were, what were you feeling? I was terrified. I was frozen. I couldn't move. If we could go back and change that. And as she changed it and moved the color through, you saw it stop. And then it started again. It started coming back. Not as bad. I said, there's a second scene like this. She said, yes. He relapsed. And then he pinned me to a wall and was choking me when he was high. And those are the two times when her brother, who was her closest best buddy kind of a thing, tried to kill her within the past year and a half when he got on drugs and was hallucinating and having some bad experiences. And after that, she's like, you know, I was like, I'm not sure about this 14-year-old girl wanting to do therapy anymore. She was the first person to sign up for my return trip to Chicago 6 weeks later. And she's like, I want to talk to the energy dude again about colors. And I said, you know what, you'd make a great psychologist. I said, you're very energy sensitive, which is true and may be a part of her journey. But she was beyond. The first subject we ever measured in 2000 here in Tucson with biofeedback equipment was an Afro-American girl who I had noticed that her eyes were very sensitive. But when she go into memory, she was that way. It was very, very obvious, the alpha-theta state. That's not REM because you can't be in REM and be conscious. And she's fully conscious. This is a different brainwave state we're working with. It's an alpha-theta wave. Now, like Scott said, you can do it through breathing. You can do it through energy. You can transmit it, healing touch, and create safety across the room. You can set it through intention. You can have them breathe their safe scene color. I talked about the drone, Harold Moses, the drone, did the throat chakra. When I listened to it, I reframed 8 memories with this sound in the background, creating a perfect harmonic fractal fifth is what he calls it. And it was able to create enough perfection around the throat chakra that it was easy to access memory. So what we want is surrounding safety around the client. With this technique, you're being trained to create quadruple redundancy. So your voice in their ear or across the room, a gentle, caring, concerned voice. The more you work on yourself, the better your frequency, by the way, is. So you're transmitting white light with your voice. You put your hand on C7, you're reinforcing your voice with actual energy going to the primary trauma center of the body, the dorsal channel of the spine. Then we know from all the energy psychology, your energy field is encompassing the client. You can be measured easily at 35, 40 feet wide in all directions. You're creating a cocoon around the client by your intention. You can do it holographically and create the same cocoon. And they're moving their safe color through their own body using their own primary brainwave, personal brainwave frequency for safety. Their green is not our green. It's a very different green frequency. Their frequency, we don't use color. We're using brainwave frequency, using the language of color to transmit complex information. So they have quadruple redundancy for safety, just with the voice, the hand, the energy field, and the color, which, knock on wood, knocking on my desk right now, we haven't had a lawsuit, because if you create that much safety, then the client really knows that they're safe to work on themselves. And that, who are they going to sue? Themselves? That one client tried to sue Hyatt or something like that because she said her pain increased, but she had relapsed on alcohol, was drinking a bottle a day, and was popping Xanax at will, and she then realized she'd signed the disclaimer, you know, saying if I'm using alcohol and or benzodiazepines, my pain may come back or not go away. But then I realized she got into such violent memories, she had not actually worked on her 7 car accidents. And that's why the pain was coming up in her neck and shoulders. She worked on a few homicidal ones. So anyway, back to her, yes.
I'm sorry, I was gonna say something about what Scott said about children and C7. And what I was gonna point out is that everybody on the call, all of you know, if you've ever picked up your child or a child that was scared and put them on your shoulder, think about where you put your hand. The first place you put your hand is on C7.
And if we called it the maternal nurturing point,
right,
is what they refer to it as. In Chinese acupuncture, it's called the hammer point.
Yep.
Some call it the anchoring point for the golden card. They believe the soul actually astrally travels to and from the body. It's why you feel like you're falling back into your body sometimes when you reconnect at the C7 point at the golden cord. I find that every memory has a frontal and rear access point. So if you can't work with the back, they're lying down, you can work with the front. When I was first trying to learn to feel energy, if I got both hands positioned correctly, the pain equalized in both hands and the client went wah, and they showed visual access. So that's how C7 first, I think our body, the scientists haven't proven this, but your body creates a holographic image, probably the way physics creates a holographic image, reference beam, object beam. So I think the spine, the dorsal channel functions as the reference beam, and the object in front is the icon that is, you know, I'm sorry, what is it, reference beam, object, yeah, functions as the object beam. And when the two intersect at some point in consciousness, then you're looking down or perceiving it three-dimensionally. So I call the name the technique because we are at least analogously creating support for a holographic projector. And so the technique, whether it's by your voice, your presence, having the client breathe, but even if they're breathing, if they're in your presence, you are doing energy work on them. You're exchanging energy in your field, and by your intention and your presence, they will feel that safety and interact. You know, the whole thing was Milton Erickson, the father of modern hypnosis, the poor little man in the wheelchair. People would just walk in and say, oh, look, poor man in the wheelchair, feel safe, non-threatened, and go into trance. They just start accessing their memories much faster because he was clearly no threat to them. And that was an advantage that he had that disarmed them and brought them into alpha theta or alpha theta delta much faster. You know, so Our voices help too. The more work you do on yourself, the more frequencies are present in your voice and they communicate across the distance, across the room. At Miraval, I'm not gonna be touching. I will not be touching clients at Miraval for the next 6 months, a year, who knows. I'll be working across the room at a safe distance there. In my private practice, people fly in. If I'm sure they're secure and have been doing all the precautions, I'll put my hand on C7. That's fine, but they'll have the option. So anyway, Scott, but yes, children are doing it on each other. I had a little boy once who I did the whole technique, yes, no, about an abusive event from a babysitter. And he got into the car afterwards, and his brother said, I have a headache. He turned, looked at him, and said, is it inside, outside, or both? And he went straight into the technique. His mother almost drove off the road because he didn't talk during the technique. I wasn't sure he was even getting it. And he memorized the whole technique and did it on his brother and got rid of his headache in the car when he left. So kids particularly are great with color. Like, what colors do you want to move through your body? Those of you that do healing touch, the kids are seeing color when you do that. They won't always tell you. You can say, what colors are you seeing? Ask. What colors are you seeing? Because they can pin down their colors and say, in the future, when you're anxious or fearful, please, you know, breathe that color. Carrie's done it on a bunch. She's done bone work ever since COVID's hit. And you've done it on a couple of six-year-olds now, I think, huh?
Yeah, I've done both. The way I've started on six-year-olds, and I don't know if this is right or wrong, is the first session I've done level twos, just to kind of get them introduced to the practice. And these are half hour, you know, med check visits where I'm like, you know, they're on a medicine for anxiety or ADHD or something. And then the rest of the time we have this for the session. And so today I did a level one on a super wiggly six-year-old. And, you know, we kept our social distance because they came in person. And so she laid on the floor because that kept her from like falling out of the chair and rolling around.
Right.
And she laid on the floor to do a level one, but it was great. It worked and she got through it. And her memory that came up, it's so cool. It was her at three. Both pets and her great grandmother, who was her best friend, all died boom, boom, boom within a few months. That was the memory that came up. And after she'd done like four reframes, her 3-year-old self still was scared. And so she came up with another thing, and so, but got it. And then she said, yep, she's good now. And so we did a SUD score. She said, oh, it was a 10. It was the top when we started, but it's gone now.
It's just hilarious
when you have a kindergartner telling you this, you know. It was very fun.
Nice. The adolescents that I had exposure to, they were always my favorites. They were so good. Gigi, you had a question or something?
Yeah, I was just wondering, are you hopeful that you may be able to get a lot of these kids off of meds with enough HMR?
Amen. You bet. Absolutely.
Yeah. Carrie is a psychiatrist. I don't know if I mentioned that. Also. So, yeah, very good. That's exciting. Well, yeah, you know, and like the RA stuff, the things we're getting, we need to really get these cases together and publish them. You know, we're getting with the RA, and there's a lot the children are picking up and being given diagnoses for that clearly are somatically accessible, and the things that, and they work beautifully with color frequency. I always like to work with anger issues with children. That was my favorite, because like Carrie said, start by blow shit up. You know, I'm just kidding. I wouldn't say that language, but let's pile up all your frustration and anger with mom and the family and whatever they've been doing to you. Can you see how big the pile is? Yes. What would you like to do with that? I don't know. What can I do? Do you want to throw it at anybody? I can do that. Sure, you can do anything you want. You know, it's holographic space. You're not going to hurt anybody. Oh, I'm going to throw it at a couple of people. Some of those kids that picked on me at school, I'm going to plop it on their heads. I'm going to feed it to them. You know, okay. And they're like, oh, you can do that. Just giving them permission to be creatively angry is what discharges it. And like, oh, I can be angry. It's okay to be angry like that. I'm not going to hurt anybody. No, in holographic space, you don't want to hurt anybody, would you? No. So the alpha theta state, they're clear that they're with you and they're not going to harm anybody. That's the gift of alpha theta. But the visual imagery feels very affectively real. You know, when I talked about Virginia Satir and like how we do our heritage descendancy in the therapy field, you know, Virginia Satir trained Sharon Wickshider Cruz, who trained the people at Baton Rouge General, you know, CDU, who then trained me. So it's like fourth generation. And then when I did the technique on Sharon Cruz and Joe Cruz, you know, years later, she's like, oh my God, this is part of Virginia Satir's work, but you're doing it holographically without having to do a chair, an empty chair, and beat the crap out of it with a bataka. You're able to do the whole thing holographically and blow things up and vaporize them without rendering harm to anybody or even getting blisters on your hands. I said, yes. So we're doing holographic psychodrama, which Carrie and I were discussing that. Psychodrama is a very interesting technique for inpatients, but if each patient had to do a psychodrama on their family history, you'll be there for years, months, you know. It's not the most financial best use of resources. But in holographic space, I have a client, every time I've worked with him, he was in treatment by the time he was 18. He went through like 6 inpatient treatments. He eventually got it on his own, you know, kind of figured it out with the 12-step programs. But he's the fastest. I told you about 12-step people. They're the fastest you'll ever work on. They've done everything but HMR. They've done everything but reframe the memory. And so when you give him a chance, he's like, yeah, it's in my, a little bit to the right of my heart this time, slightly above it too. And it's kind of throbbing, pulsating. It has a black line running through it. How old are you? I'm 8. What's happening? Now some boys beat me up and, again, made me feel really bad about myself. So if we could change that, what would you like to see happen? And he's reframing it. And he's never done less than 12 memories in a session. He's gone up to 20. And that's with time to spare. Sometimes that, like, okay, do you want to do any more? I think maybe we'll kind of just ground at. No, I'll ground after this. That's good enough for me for now. Completely articulated in every single metaphor movement is pinpoint precise. It's a different memory. We'll work around the heart. All 20 memories will be around the heart. It's in my heart. Now it's to the right. Now it's to the left. You're going to learn infinite patience as you do this, because I'm convinced I'm going to have a client. They're going to have like 120 memories, and it's all in my left shoulder area. And you're going to have to pursue that until the bursitis or whatever it is gone finally. And then like, well, it wasn't bursitis. It was 120 memories. But a lot of chronic pain is a series of layered memories, but the client will guide you through the sequencing. Their body will guide you. So it's back to Scott's original statement. I think when we get really stuck and we don't know how to proceed with a person's history, even know if they remember what happened to them, I do think we can go to the body as the foundation. And as long as we make the body very safe, the body will begin mapping. That's the seventh breakthrough in around 1996 was when I put my hand over the cancer patient and her body took over the technique. And some of the memories coming up seemed initially irrelevant. Like, what in the world does that have to do with cancer below her sternum? But it all had to do with serious compromises to her immune system. Sometimes, and we're going to see this with COVID. We're already seeing it. I'm sure you've already seen this. People that had COVID when they were younger, all their memories of trauma that created physiological anomalies are now coming up with the serious compromise of their immune systems. So the client that had chickenpox that then went into shingles later in life got a case of shingles after COVID. The client that had a Baker's cyst on her leg that was small, but very, fairly insignificant, but when she was younger, but kind of faded away, it suddenly blew up to the size of a cantaloupe. And they're like, well, it seems to have irregular cells in it now. Something else is wrong with this. You know, people that had, I had bronchial issues as a child. I almost died at 2.5, where I'm still having pain from the virus, which I think I had, by the way, in December and January, is in the lung pain that is now finally subsiding. I'm also doing pressured yoga stretches on my lungs to re-strengthen them. But there's still a pain sometimes in the center of my lung. Now they're going to start, the studies are going to come out. You can see all the COVID studies about lung scoring. There's damage to the lungs and the areoli and parts of the lungs that's going to come up. Carrie and I both believe we've had it, and we both have the same lung pain, and we're still struggling with it, you know. And it causes a deep, profound coughing sensation. Somebody at Mirabal coughed, if those of you that don't know that part, somebody at Mirabal coughed on me on December 21st. By December 23rd, when I was leaving for Christmas, I couldn't smell or taste anything. And then my ears started to fill with fluids, and that started. And I still have a little fluid in my ears. I went to the doctor, like, well, I don't see anything in there, but, you know, if you're feeling, I know the fluid's there. I can feel it slosh around something. It's evaporating because in Tucson, we don't have any water. So it all has to evaporate sometime. If I look like a prune, my ears will feel better. Okay, what can I say? But in the end, the symptoms and, the whole thing and the coughing, I don't remember much fever, but then I burned off viruses really quickly. And I traveled with people that had respiratory risk, and she didn't get it. But I talked to my guys and said, if I'm getting the flu, don't let Glenda, don't let so-and-so get sick with this, because she could die. And I'm not going to let that happen. That's not going to take place. And she did not get sick. So I don't know. I did take a little tiny antibody test 3 weeks ago. Nothing came up. So that test is too late for me to even measure whether I had it or not. So there, Mayo has a better antibody test they're coming up with that might give us more information. I'd like to know if I'm immune, then I'll send you all my plasma if you get sick or something. You know, we'll do that. But anyway, so lungs, so where you were sick previously, Carrie could talk about that. You've had a bunch of childhood physiological things, but I think we're going to see where we come in, where this is so important, is where they had childhood traumas that may have led to vulnerability or a virus. A lot of people had chickenpox, then they had warts, simplex, and sometimes they had plantar warts, you know, their feet. Then they ended up with mononucleosis as a teen. Then they ended up with Epstein-Barr in their college years. And then suddenly they have shingles as an adult, young adult. This is a classic 5 sequence. I've also had clients with ALS and PLS that had that same sequence. So I think there are things that weaken our immune system when we're younger, but COVID is like dropping down on the whole immune system. And so whatever was there unfinished, that's where HMR is really good to come in and say, we need to reframe the memory of your childhood illness could trigger the pain. The memory of childhood illnesses and viruses. Carrie and I were working on the fact that it's possible that we don't have the virus itself as much a problem as the memory of the pain from the viruses or the physiological PTSD flashback from having had the painful conditions of the viruses. You can have PTSD from the viral conditions of the past, which then subsequently are weakening the immune system and causing these weird sights in people to come back and rear their heads as trauma. Now suddenly my knee is aching and hasn't ached in 30 years. Now my shoulder's hurting. I'm like, I haven't had my shoulder hurt since I had that ski accident. If we didn't reframe things correctly, and we didn't have HMR 10, 20, 30 years ago, if we did not reframe the memories correctly, there was a chance that in your client or yourself, if COVID hits, it's gonna bring up whatever is unfinished. So even before you get sick, that's always our goal with HMR. Let's just reframe all our memories so that should our immune system be compromised by anything, we're gonna be stronger and more resistant and recover faster. And Carrie's was great giving me feedback. Yeah, I came in, you know, 80% of my pain is gone from when we started working. I'm like, well, let's keep that momentum going and clear all of the things.
Yeah, my hope is, so since I've had COVID, my autoantibodies for Sjogren's and lupus are literally off the chart elevated. Mm-hmm. So like greater than 8 times the upper limit of normal, right? And so I'm rechecking them in a few weeks. Brett and I did 80 some. So Brett and I did 80 some memories in this like 3.5 days this weekend, and then did some at probably before that we'd probably have done, so probably altogether we've probably done 200 in the last months. All of it during, I had COVID in February, and so started this up in March, and so just kind of hammering this out because I was like, I can't get, you know, I'm not going to get another autoimmune problem. And so I'm really excited to find out if the titers have come down. I definitely do feel better. I mean, there's no question that there's been an additional step in the right direction. So
yeah, you look better when you left, but you're looking downright perky right now. So that's good. Like
considering
that.
I had a 12-hour day. Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. So, yeah.
But I had, you know, 3 HMR sessions, you know, stacked with all my med management sessions. So that was great. But I do have a question about, so I have an 11-year-old boy who had pretty severe sexual trauma by a stepbrother at the ages of 7 and 8. Mm-hmm. And we've done a few HMR sessions, and each time we meet, we add a little bit more to his safe scene. And he's been pretty freaked out by the whole energy thing. So even though his mom is like totally gung-ho and his dad's totally fine with it, he's like, this is so weird. Just because, you know, I'm scanning him from afar. And I said, well, you know, like right over your left or his right eye is where his headaches would come up. And he's like, how did you know? And so he's been working, you know, in his, you know, 11 going on 5, just because he's pretty arrested emotionally. But
right.
But he's working through that. So I had him come in person so we could do the chi ball, you know, just rub
right.
our hands together.
You said you were gonna bring him in, huh?
And then we played catch with the chi ball. He's like, oh, I felt it. And that helped a little bit. What's been interesting is that he hasn't touched on any of the serious trauma. Each time we go back and forth between memories from ages 9 and 10 and then 4 and 6, and we just keep going back and forth. You know, we're not ready for the hot potato stuff yet. And I think just by him developing his safe scene, we've taken his younger selves to the safe scene each time, especially the ones younger than the trauma, to kind of help foster that building of that safety. I don't know what it's going to take for him to be able to work on the heavy duty stuff. However, he had you know, he was meeting criteria for disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, which for those of you who see kids, that's like 1 foot in bipolar, 1 foot in autism, and 1 foot in PTSD all at the same time, essentially. And, you know, horrible violence, you know, multiple holes in the walls and doors at the house, really aggressive, out of control. And his therapist, who I've known for 20 years, had kind of given up. And she's like, I've done everything I know how to do with my training for PTSD, and she's excellent with trauma. And so we've just done 3 sessions of HMR, and for 6 weeks, he's had 0 aggression, 0 violence. Mm. It's just been incredible. That I've known him for med management for a couple years prior to this. Mm. Yeah, it's just been incredible, despite the fact he's completely freaked out by the energy part.
Right. Well, that's why I have my hand on something, like, wow, your hand's really hot. I said, yes, but you know, any massage therapist or physical therapist can feel the muscle tension from a membrane and can feel that tension in the body. But I know you're not touching. That's where there's a little advantage, like if your state allows you to touch or have any contact.
Yeah, and I might see if he's okay with it next time. But at least he came in person so we could do the qi ball, have our 6-foot distance, and helped him out a little bit.
Well, you're raising an energy psychologist. So there you know. You never know what's going to happen there. You're teaching him. If somebody taught me to feel energy in my hands when I was like 11, I was like, oh my God, where would I be now? This would be so cool. You know, it took me like 13 years starting in 92. I could feel a little bit with my right hand and nothing with my left when I started healing touch. And then by practicing and sending with the right and then scanning with my feminine intuitive three-dimensional self, I can catch a ball very quickly with my feminine holographic self. But by learning to scan with the left, it learned really quickly what incest or murder or death or violence or rage felt like. Once you learn to do that, you could scan somebody as a hologram and still feel the same sensations. But if you've not learned what those sensations are by practicing it, it's a little trickier. You learned it through healing touch and mm-hmm. from other practices that you did. But the real gift of the C7 lesson initially with physical clients, which is now challenged, but with physical clients is like, oh, wow, the incest left and I felt that go through the body, or that grandma died when I was so young. It feels like death feels like a sharp, incisive, single moment stabbing pain. Abandonment is a coolness. It feels like, you know, something's withdrawn from you. Narcissism is like standing in front of an iceberg and all it does is draw warmth from you and doesn't give energy back. So there's like 30, 50, you know, it's still evolving kind of sensations about what things come up, you know. Or if they're saying, you know, I feel like a homicidally violent, I feel a violent thing going through my head and you can feel that, but obviously they're alive. You're going to have to find out where that kind of violent energy is coming from, because it's not from their own personal experience. In some cases, it's the parent that got it from the grandparent that's passing it on through verbal abuse, even though it was physical originally. So you get intergenerational subtleties coming through the energy fields. You don't necessarily say that to the client directly, but you can say, if you get a level 2 on intergenerational stuff, pile up all this violence you're feeling in your head. How big is the pile? If you ask the pile where it came from, who's in the lineup, that's an intergenerational processing. Oh, my mom is there, but her father, who used to beat the daylights out of her, is there, and his father, who beat him, is there. So if we could give all the violence back to where it came from and ask God, the angels, whatever, to help them heal. Oh, well, that great-grandfather has a big pile. Grandfather has a big pile. My father has his own pile, but my mother, you know, he was not really the person. Anyway, so you give it back, and how much is left that's actually yours? Well, none of it is mine. Very little of that is mine. Let's run a color through, and the violence goes through your hand, and you're like, okay, it's gone. How does your head feel? Wow, that's weird. My head feels so much lighter. I don't feel that kind of violence. But it's physically real. I think there are probably instruments that could measure. I think the QEEGs might be able to measure the intergenerational violence that comes through sometimes. From when we did our measurements in 2016, just the memory of where her head had been banged into a wall by the boyfriend before the session and after the session, the intensity of the memory was gone, was diminished. But some people feel intergenerational trauma as almost like a physically violent act to themselves. So I'm wondering if that will show up under a QEEG too. That's going to be interesting to find out. So, so how are we doing time-wise? Good. Other questions? So the kids are fascinating. Let's keep the stories coming. I don't get to work with as many kids. Miraval won't let anybody younger than 17 in to the premises. I have not the opportunity to do that. But those of you working with kids, we need to keep the dialogue going about that. They are magic with C7 and color. They're just amazing. You can have them draw pictures of the bad scene. We've done that with the art therapists I've trained. We'll have them draw the bad picture, and they'll pick their crayons or do sand play and use the bad figures, dinosaurs, monsters to depict the bad man that molested me. Then you say, if we could change that scene, what would you like to change in the scene? You know, like, oh, well, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that's outdated. I'm probably beyond Transformers even now. But they'll bring in something to rescue and save them. Pokemon, something really probably. But they'll bring in something to rescue, and let's, okay, does it feel safe now? Yes, let's close your eyes and breathe the colors. What's your favorite color in the corrected image? Breathe the color through your body, and you'll see them calm down. It'll just calm down. So whether you do it through art, internal art, color, you know, have them revisualize it the way they want it. I have had kids that, you know, I like, a lot of kids don't go into memory. They just throw the object out and replace it with color. But those that are, like Carrie, that you're working with, that really do have trauma moments and specific abuse histories, they often do have to go into the memory to change it. They remember enough about it to need to change it. Others like, and that's just like a disc in my throat. How old are you? I don't know that. What would you like to do with it? Sail it like a frisbee? Take all the time you need to do that. Done. What color would you replace it with? Sometimes they look at us like we're stupid and we're talking too slowly, you know, like you need to speak faster. Keep up with me, you know, they're like, I'm moving faster than you are, you need to keep up with me, therapist, you know, and run the colors through. But they're amazing, they're so fast with color frequency, so that's really helpful. Anything that can create that alpha theta though, but it's music, sound, vibration, intention, aromatherapies, who knows, but what works for a person, what creates that relaxation, allows to create the affective bridge to transmit the proof of safety. We're not changing your history. We're just proving to your 95% that you're not in your history. And fortunately enough, the trance maintains a lot of the pain in the body and the tension. Okay. See, Lawrence is here. I saw a glimpse of you, Lawrence, for a moment. Any questions from anybody? Other questions coming up? I think our mics are all off. Jeanette, we might need to activate mics. You've solved all the problems in the world.
So, is that a harp behind you?
Yes, that is, actually. Can you see my harp?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, what can I say? I work with the angelic realm. You got to have a harp. Right? Got to have a harp. Well, with COVID, the good news is I have harp practice time, so we can actually be working on harp. It has all its strengths for a change, you know, and is actually in tune. So, but no, you're not going to get a concert today. Okay. Other cases or questions, successes, challenges?
I have a question, Brent.
Of course you do, Ramona. You always have something to come up with. You're dealing with the heartbreak of Canada up there somehow. So how are you doing up there? Is everybody freaking out, or are you doing all right?
No, I started to see clients face to face.
Okay.
But they make me wear this mask and face shield, and my glasses are getting steamed up. Like, and,
yeah.
And exactly. It's like, oh, anyway, so I'm just seeing like 2-3 people a day, but it's still very difficult.
Right.
Oh, but I take my shield off sometimes because I cannot breathe. So
Well, it won't be good if you pass out during the therapy session.
That's right. Okay. So they'll be traumatized that the therapist passed out.
Right. I killed my
Anyways,
therapist.
I picked up this. I picked up this client who is 35 now, but at age 17, he was beaten up by a gang so badly that he was knocked down unconscious. He had a lot of concussions, and he was stabbed all over his body, and he was in a coma for weeks. And we are doing fine. The problem is that he tends to linger there. He's dissociating a lot. So he tends to stay too much into the memory, right? He relieves it.
Okay.
One problem. The other thing is, how do I reframe those weeks of unconscious, being unconscious in the hospital? Do I need to look at it?
When I get stuck, I go to color, ask the color question. If you can articulate it as a color frequency question, like with chemotherapies, with seizure disorders, what is the one? Anesthesia. Anesthesia is one of our most common. You always check your client for anesthesia history if they have surgeries. Because if you're an intuitive and you're an empath and you sit next to your client and suddenly you feel like you're having ether or you're sedated or Novocaine's going through your mouth, you're like, it is. It's coming from your client. And the way you can test it is place your field, your white light field, between you and the client. I did this past week with somebody on the phone. I was like, okay, I'm feeling really a heaviness. I did it with somebody at the healing intensive too. I'm like, this is not right. Something's wrong. So I had the whole group run colors through their body to release the effects of any anesthesia they've had. So I would say you can articulate a question from the time that you were comatose and sedated or medicated or in the coma state. Is there a color you need? Colors you need to move through your body for, even for a period of time, maybe days, maybe weeks. What colors do you need to move through your body to release the effects of the coma and any drugs that you got while you were comatose? So I don't know if they're sedated during the coma, kept asleep or beer. Sometimes comas are induced, so they're keeping you in a drug state, which is like anesthesia, which means there's going to be a trauma from that degree of anesthesia. They're keeping you just short of death so you can heal.
Mm-hmm.
That's what anesthesia, the body takes anesthesia a lot of times as a trauma event. And so like somebody had their tonsils out this past week. I'm like, oh God, I had to make sure I reframe. I checked my body on that one because I remember the nurse coming at me with the black mask with the ether and like, oh, and the horrible smell, like they're killing me. So my first screaming words after my tonsillectomy with no voice and no throat were, how could you do this to me? So I totally traumatized my family when I came out from under anesthesia. So the whole time I was under anesthesia, it's like they're trying to kill me. They're trying to hurt me. And the minute I came out, my first articulated words were, why would you do this to me? How could you do this to me? And I was convinced some large giant person was trying to smother me with a horrible gas, some sort of. So anesthesia has to be reframed. So his coma would need to be reframed. Now, with a situation like that, there's several, a bunch of T-minus one moments in the sequence. I'm not sure each stab wound needs to be reframed individually, but the thought enters my mind that any kind of a stab to the body would probably be, for most people, a T-minus one moment. So when you get a vet, like the vet that had the piece, I mentioned this in the past, part of the blade on an industrial mower hit a rock, and the rock flew up 440 yards and took out his right jaw. And he passed out in the grass and nobody knew he was there. They thought he had left. And he came to, the mower is gone. And so when the impact occurs, when you're stabbed, usually a physically violent act needs to be reframed. So I'm not sure how many, you might need to ask, how many times were you stabbed and do you remember them all individually? If you do, the reason it keeps going back is I'm still being stabbed. You haven't gotten me out of it yet. So a stabbing, one stabbing is bad. I had a client that did. He got stabbed in the back. And we did go to that memory two or three times to undo the stabbing in the back thing. There were different features. One was being the fact that he was being mocked before he was stabbed. The other time was the guy snuck up behind him and stabbed him. The other time he was walking around trying to do something, so I didn't realize he had a knife in his back. So coming to the realization, you have been stabbed. So there are three parts to the stabbing, the one stabbing. Now, different stabbing moments could need to possibly be individually reframed. So you're going to have to take slow it down and take them through the whole sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have that not happen. Is there a particular, and see whose body brings it up. Is there a site? Where have you stabbed in your body? Do you have pain there? If he has pain there, the stabbings are still intact.
Oh, yeah.
Would you so you got to reframe the stabbings, and then he was kicked and knocked, and they did something else to him. There's a whole series. He might have 10, 15 different T-minus-1 moments in a violent sequence like that. I've never done that many with a person. Usually it's 5 to 8, and most vets might go up to 10 or 12. Like when I got shot, then I realized my arm is missing. Then I realized the guy next to me was dying. Then he died. Then I passed out. Then when I came to, they were discussing whether I would live or die in the helicopter. Then I got there and I was in horrible pain and the meds wore off. And then, you know, whatever, then the physical therapy had to take place and they did have to amputate my leg. So that's the 7th or 8th memory. You have to honor the violent sequence, the moments of encoding in the sequence.
Well, he's not remembering very much any sequence, right?
Well, I would work on a lot of safety and tell you if you start getting, You know, the thing you do, if he's getting pieces of, is he getting fragments, a piece at a time or something?
Well, once he became unconscious, he does not remember being stabbed, right?
Okay, so that might be a good thing. Actually, you could do, maybe do that as one reframe. But my suspicion is, okay, one of the blessings of the technique and the development of the technique is I feel the pain site as a trauma, even if the client recorded no memory of it.
Yep.
And so you and I, an empath, will feel it. I scan people's heads. It's like the woman I scanned, I told you last year, I was scanned, some of you were there. I scanned a woman, I felt burning electricity in my head, like static electricity, but it was under the skull. And I'm like, what the heck is this? I've never felt anything coming from the client. But I felt it in my skull mirrored. So I was like, I'd already taken a history. Her head was supposed to be fine. I said, have you ever had an electrical trauma to your brain? And she's like, oh, funny you would ask that. When I was an infant, my parents told me, I don't have any memory of this. They said they put me in an electric blanket because it was cold up north. And somehow either they or my little foot hit the high button. And I was left wrapped in the electrical blanket for over an hour. When they found me, I was unconscious. They brought my temperature down to 104, rushed me to the hospital. The nurses said it was a miracle my brain didn't boil, was the client's language. So she was horrified. And the parents are horrified that, oh my gosh, you're going to have brain damage. And she said, it's funny, I don't have any memory of that, but when you said that, it completely came back as something my parents had reported. So the advantage of the empathy, and those of you that are scanners and a bit shamanic or whatever, is that you're picking up stuff from clients that they don't even have any conscious memory of. I'm not sure, the body will remember it, but they may not have any conscious memory of what took place. So, the fact that he was stabbed, I can promise you, his body has trauma memory of the stabbings.
It did, because it one stab it came up, and he was he wasn't aware of it. I mean, he knew he was stabbed.
Yeah, I would say if he keeps returning to it, doesn't even know why, there's a good chance his body is sort of volunteering him and is saying, you need to go through the stabbing sequence, and hopefully it's not too many, but these multiple stab wounds, there are people that can have 16, 18 stab wounds and they survive, you know, but you might need to reframe the individual violations. It's very graphic. They're very physical.
So,
if
so
you're
when
pretty
you,
empathic too, if you scan him and you feel it.
Oh my gosh,
hands,
no, I didn't scan him. And
yeah, no, some people are too scary to scan, I think, sometimes.
No, I didn't scan him, but as soon as he told me, like, my head hurts and so on, my head started to hurt. Okay. I felt
that if they start talking about anything and you're getting a resonance with it, you need to reframe that piece of it.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be like peeling an onion. You can do a few pieces of it over time and maybe he'll disclose more. And same thing with Carrie, you were talking about the little boy with the sexual abuse. My guess is it's going to come up somatically somewhere for him and it'll cue you and you'll have a way in, maybe through a gentler memory, somebody teasing him or pushing him or something. And then he'll start to get earlier memories about something like that. The body, if you're not ready for it, the subconscious, your higher self will kind of help you work your way into accessing the memory more gently, and it'll start to come up and surface in a manner that is generally more acceptable. But I have clients that even when it starts coming up in the gentlest ways, they're like, oh no, I see this. I don't want to do this right now. I'm not ready for this. Like, okay, let's go back to your safe scene. And as a reminder, some of you, I don't know if you remember in training, there is the blessing sphere. One thing we teach people to do with flashbacks is take the image or the piece of the memory and put it in a sphere. It's like the holy man used to say, bless your enemy. Well, bless the thing scaring you. If you surround the flashback, the fragment of the memory in a sphere, teach the little boy. If we can handle anything that comes up. The other thing, Carrie, I forgot to mention with him, is there's a thing I do with children when they look really scared. And I had it because I had a client that every time I tried to focus on a metaphor, it changed location. It became Goofy the cartoon character, it became a gas pump, it became a basketball. It was like there is a phenomenon called hide and go seek, which occurs with metaphors. They will start jumping around the body and eventually they reveal themselves to be like Goofy, you know, or like, you know, olive oil, whatever you call, what's her name, Popeye's, you know, what, you know, it'll be some kind of silly thing, a basketball, a baseball, a golf ball. You know, balloon that comes up with a pig on it or something. You're like, what the heck? And you're like, they're playing hide and go seek with you. They're throwing out metaphors to say, help me, but I'm too scared to go into the metaphor and do anything with it. So if you see the child starting to get close, but coming up, but playing hide and go seek, Richard Schwartz with IFS called it direct accessing. I think I called it direct dial. One of us, I forgot who called it what. Anyway, we came up with the same thing at the same time. Talk to the subconscious of the little boy without him realizing it. You know, if something bad did happen to you at any time, you know, and it was when you were little, we don't even know right from wrong until we're 7 or 8. So nothing that happened would ever be your fault, and nobody would ever blame you or accuse you of anything. And even if sometimes things felt good to be mean or hurtful to people or whatever, you know, if it really shouldn't have been done and they shouldn't have done that to us, it's not your fault. It's the fault of the person that did it to you. And there can be certain like guilt because I think I liked it or because something felt nice when he touched me there. And that happens a lot with the sexual abuse, the touch part, especially they'll target children with no fathers, no touch, no affection, no compassion, no comfort, dad's alcoholic, a scary person. And this poor little boy is just going to be run through the ringers, you know, and like, oh, but I thought the touch was nice. And because I enjoyed it, the touch felt nice. I'm guilty and I'm ashamed and I can never talk about this horrible thing I did. So sometimes you do direct dialogue. You might try a little bit directly accessing the child of the age at which you think it happened and speak to the child. If you talk to that child and say, no matter what you ever did, I will never judge you. We'll always care about you. You'll always be safe. Anything that should come up is not going to be your fault. I would never think badly of you or judge you for anything. And you hear my voice. I'm assuming that I'm talking to a younger child. Mm-hmm. And by doing direct dialogue to the younger child, even if it's just a few things like, you know, you're amazing. You're such a good person. And no matter what might have happened, anything happens before 7 or 8 years old is premoral, before we even know right from wrong. So it would not be our fault. But as shame, we often feel terrible about things done to us. And when we take that picture, we think it's our shame because we took the picture and stored it in our computer. And so when I stored that bad picture with the bad feeling in my computer, I thought it was about me. And that's how we know shame becomes owned by you. You think it's your stuff, you know, that it lives in your body. We took the picture and the only place we could control the perpetration was inside our computer. So now the shame's taken up residence, and eventually if you feel embarrassed about it, you won't talk about it, you forget where it came from or push it away. You still feel the shame, but you don't remember who put it there. You know, and so it can be things like that. So I've done techniques like that with people. You know, you get pretty desperate sometimes to get them to the safe place so they can finally talk about it. But I'm like, you know, that when he started jumping around the body and showing me weird metaphors and like jumping all over the place, I'm like, hold on. I started talking. It was like an adult, but I'm like, I got a 2-year-old on my hands playing hide and go seek. So I did. I spoke to the 2-year-old or the 3-year-old. I said, you need to know I'm not here to make you do anything you don't want to do, you've already said to this one. I'm not going to make you do anything you don't want to do. We won't go anywhere you don't want to go, stuff like that. And he says, oh. I said, what's that? The adult spoke to me. He said, that's interesting. When you said that and started talking to him, there's suddenly like a 4 or 5-year-old sitting on my lap with his arms crossed. And he's looking at you. And he says he's very impressed because nobody has ever figured out that he exists. And nobody has ever tried talking to him directly. And so he's very impressed how you knew. He still doesn't want to talk to you. But he still is impressed that you did that. It took another session or two before he was willing to talk to us about something and do a little work. And then the session went beautifully. He like came out and it's like, so there could be a part of his holding, a little shy, embarrassed about things. So I just assume once you get comfortable with the technique, it's not what they say that you notice is the trauma. It's what's missing from the picture that becomes the trauma. Like, oh, he doesn't feel calm enough, safe enough, trusting of an adult to talk about it. Or he looks like he might, oh, I can see my inner child, but he won't show his face. Well, when does the child not show their face? When they're ashamed, they've seen something. Or he's there, my inner child's there, but he has no face and no arms. Well, he's ashamed, he's embarrassed, and he's powerless. He feels powerless to do anything about it. So everything in the metaphors that come, it'll be interesting as you work your way towards it to see what kind of changes in him or the metaphors might come up. Like, oh, I see myself, but I don't have any arms. I see that, but I don't have a head, no face. Doesn't want to think about it. You know, you don't have to think about things or do anything until you want to talk about it with me in the office. You're safe. but we're not going to make you go anywhere, do anything you don't want to do. So it's not what they're saying, it's what's missing from the picture that you start concluding is the challenge. Like, why is he? Obviously, you're starting to get a feeling like there's a lot of shame or terror of some sort attached. Now, the question is, why would a child that age, if you know the age of the abuse, have that much terror? Well, either it's just physically violating, or he enjoyed part of it, thought the touch part felt nice, and he was guilty because he did something bad to the person. So he was forced to do it, he might have done something back. So when you start working with that, you kind of have to infer. Now, your intuition can come in very handy on that sometimes. You're like, okay, I got an impression, or here was he asking about this or something like that. So your guides and angels will work with you to help you with children too, to find a safe way in. You know, use that. But that it can be, it's your greatest lessons with these kids. They're amazing. Like, you know, it's like, one is like, she doesn't trust adults and she's not going to talk to you. She'll talk to me. I said, oh, okay, well, can you maybe give her a bunny? She's like, okay, she's hiding in the closet. She won't come out of the damn closet. I was like, okay, calm down. You're actually working with a wounded part of yourself that does not want to come out of the closet. She's too terrified. So I said, does she like animals? Oh, she likes bunny rabbits. Okay, give her a bunny. And she started laughing. I said, what happened? She says, a hand snuck out of the closet, grabbed the bunny, and I can hear laughter in the closet. Like, haha, I have the bunny and I'm still not coming out. But the point was, we made contact with that child that day and we started a bridge. And eventually the child was able to, yeah, okay, I guess if you give me a bunny, you're not all bad, you know. But she had the adult self or the adolescent, rebellious, angry teenage part gave her the bunny. She still wouldn't let the adult self or me get anywhere near the inner child. But she let her adolescent adult self, rageaholic, rebel, her, she's not a rebel, would go in and say, hey, Jeanette, this should sound familiar. Rebel could come in and like act on behalf of the child and make her safe. Like, yeah, Rebel comes in, you know, Rebel will do it. Rebel's angry. He's pissed off. I said, good, good. Thank your angry part. That's your protector. She says, yeah, she'll trust Rebel. She thinks she'll protect her. So the angry adolescent, eating disorder, binging, purging, pissed off part, there's a lot of times eating disorders about anger, will come in and act as the part that is the protector. And like, oh, wow, now we're connecting our angry part as the security agent. So she has a new job. And then it's like, oh, well, she has something to do. Now she doesn't have to eat, purge, binge, whatever. You know, we have to take our anger out. That way we can use it to protect the wounded child part. That's where we're getting a little bit into parts therapy with this too today. So that's where the dialogue and the integrating of the parts and useful capacities takes place. So, but you're going to use all everything in your arsenal. You're like, well, she won't let it in adults. Is there a part that she will let in? Oh, yeah. Wow, if we let that rebel that's so ticked off. Yeah, Rebel says she's not going to get near that little boy or that little girl again. Rebel will just take them out. It's like, okay, thank Rebel for that work and thank you for the job. But you know, red is not the safest frequency. We'd like to actually someday change her to white light or violet light. That's a lot scarier for people that are the blacks and the reds coming out of the cave. You know, it hurts their eyes to look at a white light. So maybe we can get the angry part to go from red to white. And then in that process, she's much more protective. So you see, we're working multiple channels, multiple layers. It can be incredibly intricate when you start mapping these part functions. But it looks like he has a piece that, you know, was like really scared, afraid to come out. But I've done, sometimes I'll throw in a little, you know, I work with thousands of inner children. I had a client, I mentioned this to some of you a few weeks ago, said, I want my wife to parent my inner child. I wish she could speak calmly enough to get my inner child to come out. It's like, we really don't want to change your wife into your mom. And we had this discussion a few weeks ago. But, and then a few minutes later, he said, in fact, I'd like your voice. I'd like for you to be more kind, more loving and compassionate. And I'm like, well, you know, I'd really love to be able to communicate that to your inner child. But I said, you know, I can take care of little Brent. But even on my best day, I don't know the colors that little, we'll call him George, that little George needs that you know the colors that he needs. I don't know his colors. And as much as I'd like to facilitate that, little George needs you and probably not your wife either. You know, I can't. And then I share with him the good news about light trance is you can do educational processing. I said, you have a lot of clients and when they turn their wife with some wonderful nurturing skills into their mommy, then intimacy sometimes kind of goes away because on some level we know we're not supposed to be intimate with our mommies. And I already knew that he had serious non-sexual interaction issues with the wife. And like, okay. So I kind of threw that in as a very gentle aside in the process. Like, you know, that thing about making your wife your mommy, that's for our work. You and I, and I raised my voice. You hear what I'm doing? I'm talking to the adult. I said, because he regressed back into the little boy. Like, I wish you would be more loving. And you know, this is a guy who did psychoanalysis 5 times a week for his first 3 years. And the analyst did not resolve any of the memories. Oh, my psychoanalyst was God. He was so wonderful. He was so amazing. He was a daddy figure that he never had. And I'm like, yeah, I wish he'd reframed your memories with you. You know, but and like, so he's trying to turn me into the psychoanalyst father figure. And it didn't work then for him. He didn't become the father. And it wasn't working now. He's not going to be, and I said, oh, no. I said, this is not that kind of therapy. And I said it to him. I was like, you know, as much as I'd love to parent your inner child, I said, I can parent little Brent. I know his colors and make him safe in a millisecond. I said, but you know, you're brilliant. I said, you're so great. And I went through his positive assets. I said, you're brilliant. And I said, you don't want your wife to parent your inner child. She's not here to be your mom. He says, yeah, I can see that. I'm afraid of mom. And then he said, and you don't want me to. I said, I can speak very kindly and lovingly. Sometimes I talk to more the adult you when the child part is coming up and the child needs comfort. And I said, I don't know his colors. You know his colors. You can go in and speak to him accurately and reach his heart and communicate that to him. He says, you know, you're right. I'm going to work on that this week. And he did. He really did much better the next time. And he called me and he sounded more in his adult. I want to do another session with you. This is really good for me. You know, I see where the blockage is. And I'm really not parenting, taking responsibility and parenting myself. You know, I was like, yeah, it's that psychoanalyst thing you have, or, you know, whatever. So you gave away, you know, it's nice that he had a role model, but he never internalized it and identified with, you know, the nurturing father figure. He never internalized it. That's where reparenting, all therapy is reparenting, isn't it? So with HMR, we're changing the language and emphasizing the focus is on the adult talking to the child and sometimes the adult, making sure that was the problem. I was the child. We have no trouble accessing children. The child parts are all over the place. They're like, yeah, I feel this and I'm sad and I'm hurting. You know, usually we don't have any trial of the children. The problem is the adult self, or like you said, the 11-year-old self is probably having an issue, is blocking the memories of the younger self. And, you know, it may not, when I was talking to the client, I said, you need to know you're much more powerful and you can heal this. And you have all the missing colors, you know, that you need to parent your little boy, your inner child. Spend some time with him this week. And he did, and he came back much, much better. But, you know, I think safety, what I was going to say is when flashback fragments come up, you can do several things. In fact, I was just going over this in my notes today because I'm updating my handouts that I give to people at the end of the session. Maybe I'll have to send you all copies of that, of what that looks like, because I've added a few things. Like there's a 14 principles of like primary site reinforcement, like where a trauma first occurs, it male or female, it can be reinforced and always come up at the original site, whether it's a male or a female. So there are 14 principles like that I teach at level 3, but I'm including it in a lighter version for clients. So I think they need to know that one of the biggest traumas is being alone, that nothing happened, there's nobody there, and you're in the yard in Kansas and there's corn and nobody's there. And they're totally traumatized looking at the new car, but they just moved. So I'm putting that in the principles about that. One of the items is about reinforcing safety. So if your client is prone to flashbacks, Carrie, you might want to have him create a gold box with a lock on it. Some kind of box that he likes, a toy box. You got a favorite box, you can put a lock on it that's really safe. And if a flashback, an image, a person, a scary thing comes up, a nightmare, you can always surround it in a sphere of silver, white, golden light, shrink it to the size of a golf ball or a baseball, and put it in your box with a lock on it. You can even plop an animal or an angel on top of it if you want. So the lock box, or the vault, as we call it, is very, very helpful. I have my clients build a titanium vault, usually with a circular deposit slot, like at the ATMs, you know, right there. That's, used to have the circular deposit. So I was like, okay, so you can put your memory in a sphere of silver, white, golden light, black and red can't escape silver, white, golden sphere, and put it in the safe. And you only bring it out at level 3. I teach you the protocol. We only bring it out. In fact, Lynn Cargillo, you know, some of you know Lynn, she's now the president. Well, there's Yeah, Karen's holding up the book, Understanding Trauma and Association, talks about that. And she doesn't even have the client bring the memory out of the safe place, out of the vault or whatever. She has like an angel bring it out if you have to. Have a safe being or person bring the memory out. And then you tap, or you do EFT, TFT, you do color, or you do HMR on it. And you actually reduce it, bring it down. And then if you're not finished, you can put it back in the sphere and put it back in the vault. If it's an evolving series of fragments or memories, I've had one or two clients over the years do that. Most of the time, you create enough safety, they just eventually walk through the memory, you reframe it, you don't have to put it back in the vault. But if at some point a person says, it's too much for me to handle, I can't deal with, that's enough for today, let's contain it. How would you like to contain it? You want to put a light around it or put it in a ball? Can you put it in your vault, in the sphere? Some people use a golden lockbox with an angel on it. So it's some kind of a containment process. Some people, I want to bury it in the yard until I'm ready to deal with it, whatever. But you can use one of the elements. But the vault and the mirrored sphere, the blessing sphere, are used for containment of flashback fragments. So if children get scary fragments, they don't know what it is. It's like, oh, no big deal. Let's put it in your golden angel box. And you and I will talk about that next week when you come back or when you're ready to talk about that. If something comes up about that, you can call me or let me know and we can work with that. But the vault, the golden box. So gold is, you can have them ask what their color is. But gold is the highest frequency of metallic lights from most cultures. By Buddha, God, Jesus, angels are all depicted in golden light. So contain it, put it in the box, lock it up, you know, and they can come back and deal with it when they want to. So that's a couple of containment things. Oh, another thing you can do for containment of a flashback image is change it to black and white. Change it to black and white. If it loses all color, it loses its emotional charge for the time being. So what I like to do is, like, you know, they have black and white. I like sepia, because sepia is in that brown beige range, which is a safety color. So I'm like, let's change that obnoxious image just to sepia. Like an old, outdated, like it's fading. Sepia occurs sometimes when pictures are fading. Let's change it to sepia and let's put it in the photo album with a lock on it. And we'll bring out the sepia picture when you're ready to deal with it. So black and white, sepia, take the color, the charge away from it, bleach it, whatever. So if you can get the color out of it, I had a client that did that one day. I came with them. It's like she said, I think I just want to take the color out. So maybe make it black and white. I was like, oh, that's a good idea. Because when you do that, you're reducing or controlling the emotional charge. It's kind of like it's history. It's a done deal. So that's another containment technique for flashback fragments. It's black and white, the vault, the sphere. These are all things that you can do should pieces start coming up. And
Brent, one thing Lynn Carhalla's book mentioned that I think the 11-year-old might love is you have the vault like you described it already. Mm-hmm. Then she has an anteroom, and the anteroom has a dial on it. So you get to decide how much of a memory you want to think about
in
that session. And the dial is like 1 to 10. So you can choose, you know, 1, 2, or 3 for the first time you work with it, and then you put it back.
Right.
And the next time you dial it up, and she said, usually they don't go up in increments of 1, they go up in increments of 2 or 3. So it takes about 3 times to get a really tough memory.
Gotcha. Yeah, and Carrie's trained with Lynn. So you probably, are you aware of that piece where the dial piece coming up, going back down?
That one, I don't know. So that, thank you, Karen. I don't have all of Lynn's books, so. I've got a few of them though, but not that one.
Is that in her latest book, Karen? Or was that in Understanding Trauma Association?
I think that's the one before.
Okay. Yeah. I don't remember that piece. I mean, she's talked about it, but so you can't do that piece. That makes perfect sense. So you could put it in like, okay, let's bring it out.
Perfect. Thank you.
Agree to what we want to work on today. And if it becomes too much or too little, we can turn it back. We can put it in the box, put it in the lock box, put it in the vault, and we'll work with it next time. That's great. That's the reduction techniques too, the EFT, TFT. You have to bring it down. I've always shot for baseline 0. I'm just a glutton for punishment. But if they can't do that, and there's a piece left, certainly that's a containment possibility.
It also reminds me of that movie Inside Out with Pixar. The movie.
Oh, right. Yeah. I never saw that one, but actually.
I wonder if that would be helpful for children to visualize it.
Maybe.
Like that too. It just hit me when you were talking about it.
The media, whatever they are familiar with, they know a lot of the Harry Potter language. So that's
okay.
Now, Inside Out's a great movie.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah. That's funny.
Cool. Good. So how are we doing? Okay, we're past our little time. Any other questions? I don't know. I don't know if Ramona, we got past your answered all your questions about things.
Yeah. I have another one. I work with another client who had a concussion, and as many times I'm trying to reframe the concussion, it's another memory that shows up.
So you're trying to target the concussion, but it keeps bopping.
Yeah, because you said that we need to clear the concussions first, right?
Preferably, because it can make your head hurt and be give you nausea and make you disturbed, you know. But often a concussion does have a prehistory. They might have gotten hit in the head or have another related, maybe not that strong.
Oh, she fell, right? This is a recent accident.
The subconscious does not operate in chronological order. So a lesser memory or a more recent memory could come up long before the original concussion memory comes up. So you just have to follow the body sequencing of that.
Yeah.
Often it's not.
Because I'm trying to get that out of the way, and it's childhood.
Well, don't get anal retentive about it. If it hasn't come, make a note that it's not resolved, because eventually her head will start hurting. She's like, this therapy isn't working. My head's worse than it was before. It's like, well, the real concussion is finally coming up. So you can actually build in pain levels. It can actually build up for a period of time until you get the memory. That's why I try to just devote a whole session to the concussion stuff and see what comes up, you know. If you can get it all done in a single reframe sequence, that's good. But okay, I just trust
you.
It. Yeah. I had a client, the one that had the lawsuit at Hyatt, you know, Miraval. Every time I try to work on her car accidents, she'd like, oh, I see myself hitting my brother with a shovel. I'm like, oh my God, she tried to kill her brother. Oh, I see myself hitting my sister over the head with a Coke bottle. I was like, oh, there's something wrong here. You know, she's sociopathic or something. I see myself giving my sister a bottle of baby aspirin and telling her it's candy. These are three things she really did. So every time I tried to just deal with what I thought was a fairly inane car accident, we went homicidal with something. She was like sociopathic or in some kind of rage issue as a young child and got these incredibly violent memories. And then I realized after the second or third session with all these violent tangential memories, we never got to the car accidents. And so her complaint was, my neck started hurting after the third session. I'm like, well, of course it did. We haven't dealt with the car accidents yet. That's why I like the software where I take the history and I have it all written down, the number of trauma memories. And I went back through the notes. I'm like, oh my God, look what the memories are. I said, did we reframe the car accidents? Every time I tried to go after the obvious, her body redirected me to something else. So I think eventually what I say is you really do want to get rid of I try to get rid of the neurological traumas, the car accidents, the whiplash first, because it could come up later in the session as a more significant pain. And I think the therapy is not working. That's not true. They just have the next actual physiologically violent memory or painful memory coming up out of sequence. And their body's working with her more traumatic memories where the guilt and shame about almost killing her siblings, you know, repeatedly. And I was bushwhacked by that because I didn't realize we hadn't gotten to the accident memories. So I do go back to those after a session or two, they're still traipsing on about other kinds of falls and injuries. I'm like, you know, we really do want to make sure we reframe. And I'll just before the end of the session, anything coming up right now? No, I feel pretty good. Let's reframe your two car accidents today before we end. And that doesn't take, that's a few minutes. Car accidents are pretty quick reframes. But you want to make sure you send in that missing signal, or their car accident pain may never go away. A lot of pain, majority of pain in the body from car accidents is the memory, it's not physiological damage. I see it all the time. The doctors treat the body, they forget to treat the memory. That's maintaining it, the trance. Mind creates body.
I have a question.
Sure.
So I did some work with this person in Del Mar, and he ended up having a massive stroke. Mm-hmm. And my friend and I, so she found him, and now, but he's been a narcissist for a long time. I did some work with him. He had some childhood sexual.
Can I back up one question for you? Is he alcoholic? Did he drink at some time?
Yeah.
Was he still drinking when you worked on him? I mean, had he been drinking, you know, not necessarily at that time.
I told him I couldn't really do too much if he was going to be drunk. Like I couldn't, it was very hard for me to like access anything because I tried to help him a bit. some stuff a long time ago, and I just did it as a friend situation. But it's, I did get his safe color, and that seemed to help. But yeah, he was still drinking after, and then he wouldn't really participate anymore in it. And he's older. He's probably,
I guess. Well, you'll need to read. You might, if he comes to and he's coherent, which he may be, I don't know if he is now. You need to reframe a stroke or a heart attack or an event like that. There's a trauma that accompanies it when they realize they're losing control of their own body. That's very
well, traumatic. That's what she's dealing with now. I was going to ask because this is the interesting part. She's always been very, what's the word, compassionate and helpful. And he was taking advantage of her a lot. And we were talking about this because now he's having issues sexually, actually. That's coming up. He can barely talk. He has lost most
of his issues, right?
Yeah. And everything. I don't even know if I could help him because I'm not there now. I could try, maybe on the computer. But yeah, so he's wondering, we're talking about this, if somebody had massive trauma to their brain, because he literally had the top of his brain removed, or not the brain, the skull removed, and just put back on. But is there a way, if somebody has massive brain damage like that, is it possible for them to lose a narcissistic behavior if they have trauma to their brain in a specific area or not?
You'd have to ask a neurologist about that one. I don't know. It depends what part of the brain is affected by the stroke. I don't know the relationship between strokes and narcissistic personality disorder. I think the personality disorder might still be there, and they could become a really uncomfortable patient as a narcissist if they feel they're limited and get more. Narcissism is anger-based. A lot of it is anger-based. And they can get... I have somebody, I'm echoing back on somebody's microphone.
I got it.
Okay, thanks. But so it's anger-based, and it depends. People mellow from Alzheimer's, people mellow from strokes. People get more angry after strokes and become worse patients. I can't tell you about that one. I will say this, the minute you say stroke, heart attack, or aneurysm, I'm going to look, I'm an addictions counselor. I'm just going to tell you that the majority of people I work with that are looking at heart attack, stroke, and aneurysms, the people I end up working with were heavy drinkers. Oh. And there is a correlation. They found the correlation in the past few years between cardiovascular problems and the alcohol is damaging the left ventricle of the heart. We've known that for some time. It's causing AFib, which then goes into high blood pressure, which then goes into heart attack, stroke, and aneurysm. Oh. And for 35 years, I've worked with adults, and I have the articles, you know. I give that to my clients, too, now. But if they mention this. So I'll say, okay, do you drink? If you know, when you drink, do you turn red, get flushed, and feel your heart racing? I said, you're now into vascular damage territory with your drinking. We know that. And it's not the sulfites. They're not allergic to sulfites. You know, if you're getting flushed, turning red, and you're, okay, this is Brent's test for your alcoholic damage. I said, get a damn blood pressure cuff out. Take your blood pressure before you have your drinks. Take your blood pressure afterwards. If you're turning red, you may already know the answer. If you're turning red, spiking, and it's going up, you're into vascular damage territory. You have to stop drinking now. They're not going to make it to cirrhosis of the liver. They're going to die of heart attack, stroke, and aneurysm. It's happening a lot. I have families that come in all the time. Oh, yeah, we have alcoholism in the family, but we don't worry about that. We all die of heart attack, stroke, aneurysm before 60. I'm like, what the heck? Something is wrong with this picture. You know, so what happens is those that got sober in their mid-40s, 50s, some of the damage had already occurred. So there's still, some of them are still dying prematurely in their 50s, 60s, 70s. I have families when I'll say that. I said the alcoholic side of the family. Look at the alcoholic side of your family. Have your cardiovascular problems? Oh, yeah, well, my dad had a heart attack, you know, before he got sober. My uncle stopped drinking, but he had an aneurysm. And my grandfather died of whatever, heart attack, stroke, and one of the three, heart attack. It's all in the family history on the drinking side. Look at the cardio damage and what's happening. I had a woman come in at 49. She's vegan. She does Pilates 5 times a week. Looked great, sounded great, amazing woman, and had a stroke at 49. For the first time, I've been waiting, 30 years for this, head of the Department of Cardiology in San Diego says there's only one thing to explain your stroke. We now understand that alcohol is damaging the left ventricle of the heart and creating this, and your stroke is due to your 2 glasses of wine every night.
Oh, she
did it for years. That's all she did, but she did 2 glasses of wine. And with her constitution, it was enough. And she said, yeah, I knew years ago when I drink wine, I see it flush turn red and I feel my heart racing. I didn't know I was on my way to a stroke, you know. But we know that now. It's all over the internet. So you can pull up tons of PDFs and articles on cardiovascular damage from alcohol. Now, a glass of wine, if you don't have the genetics, is supposed to relax you. So I tell my clients, if you have a question about this, get your blood pressure cup out. Take your blood pressure, have your glass or two of wine, then take your blood pressure afterwards. If you're spiking and it's going up, you're now in vascular damage territory. You're not supposed to be freaking out and increasing under a glass of wine. You're supposed to be relaxing. You're not doing what the wine company said. You're doing the opposite. And they're like, oh, yeah. And I had a guy come in right after the 49-year-old woman did that. He came in at 42. And he says, I don't know what, same day, actually. It's kind of weird. Same day. He says, you know, that's interesting you would say that. He says, I used to be able to drink and I had no problem. Now when I drink, my neck starts turning red. I can feel my heart racing. I was like, holy mackerel. I said, you're into AFib stuff and you're getting into vascular damage territory. Stop now. This is at Miraval about 2.5 years ago. I got a call 6 months later. I put myself into treatment. I'm in inpatient treatment. Thank you so much for saving my life. They did a test. The vascular damage is not bad, but it was there. And he says, I'm sober now and I'm going to stay there. So thank you for warning me. Said I had no idea that it was tied to the alcohol. I was supposed to be relaxing me. But then he was Irish. You know, we have all kinds of myths from being Irish now sometimes. So you never know. Anyway, so I'm part Scotch-Irish. I can say that without, you know, it's like, okay, we have a new family. You know, so be aware, you know, the cardio piece. So with the stroke part, Heather, the thing I'd say about that is you have to pick your battles sometimes.
Yeah.
And as much as I would love to, I see people all the time that have conditions, I'd love to be able to have some time to work with them. But if I hear the history and I'm like, wow, there's just too much still going on. If he isn't making the commitment to not drink now, and that is at a stroke, you probably can't drink.
Yeah,
that's one way to stop you from drinking. But if they're not coherent and the language and speech, you know, HMR is a verbal technique. But that's where it got exciting with the 2-year-old putting it on the chest of the parent, and the parent somatically went through the HMR on behalf of the child. So we may have options for surrogacy about that. I don't know what to tell you about the stroke piece, though. That's a tricky one. I've had people that are geriatric, that are older, that like wouldn't do any therapy, and then they had a stroke or an illness. I'm like, I'll do HMR. I'll do anything to try to improve the quality of my life. And they're very receptive. When you work on them, it's like working with a child. It works very well. And others like, no, just fix my heart. Give me a pill. Make it go away. I don't want to do any kind of therapy on that. So you kind of have to pick your battles about that. Yeah. So be careful. Take care of yourself. You know, by the time they're in vascular damage and they're having strokes and other things, I'm like, you know, people would love to, but he's on his way out. If he's not, he's very close to.
I was worried for my friend spending too much time with him, thinking that his personality had come out of narcissism. That's kind of where my concern was.
Yeah, they can, and you know, I'm a patient. Narcissists make nasty. We don't want to get examples. I don't want to get into politics with you all right now, but you know, narcissists are the worst in a health crisis.
Yeah, because I'm afraid he's taking advantage of her good nature during this time right now, even though he can't communicate well. So I've been kind of wondering, because I didn't work with him anymore for a while. It's been years, but I was like, she told me the other day, I thought, I'm not sure about this. I don't know.
Narcissists are not supposed to ever get sick and die. They're not supposed to have anything wrong with them. They are really ticked off if something goes poorly. It's not going to be a happy picture, but, and there may be denial that they have a disease. You know, I don't need to wear a mask. I'm too strong. I'm immune to COVID. I'm not going to get sick. You know, yeah, attitude may not be sufficient in this case, you know. So anyway, we have to, the lack of empathy of the narcissist does not make them aware of those around them very well. So anyway, good questions, though. All right, everybody, thank you for your time, energy. Keep up the good work. Keep socially distancing. Scan holographically if you need to. It works. I promise you, it can work.
Are you doing finals on Zoom? Because I need to do my final, Sam.
I don't know if I got your records. I can't find them. So you may need to send them in smaller. Resend it to me at abuna@comcast.net. So I'll take a look at it.
Okay.
And then we can talk with Karen if you need more supervision or stuff. Yes.
How can I send you the whole 90 memories? Do you need me to send them by mail or how?
You can email them. You can put them by, and if they're handwritten, you may just want to make a copy to send them by mail.
By mail, you know, okay. Yeah, they're handwritten. And
yeah, because I prefer the final exam be in person, you know, but I'm not sure you want to come down to Arizona at its peak of coronavirus right now in 110 degree heat. You might just die upon arrival. So we'll work on that, try to find a way to do that.
The border's not open.
One option is level 3 is in the fall. I do encourage some of you to, you know, do level 3 more. It's been updated. If you haven't done it in the last 2-3 years, you might want to do an updated. If you come for level 3, often I can coordinate. If I have your cases in advance, I can often review the cases and get you ready, and we can take the exam when you're in for level 3. Something like that. That's an option, a real option.
So as a payment, Brent, how?
If you've already taken it, that would just be a retake anyway, like $250 for the retake. Okay. And the hotel is very reasonable. They're happy that people are in it right now. So I'm sorry, you were saying, Ramona?
I'm saying as a payment, how do I pay for the final?
Oh, that's just a charge. Just tell me. I just run the credit card. It's like a session. It's okay. $240 for the final exam.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. Not a problem. Yeah, we got to get you certified. Come on, girl.
I think I've had most of my stuff with Karen. Yeah. Supervision.
Okay. Check with Karen. If you feel like you need some more supervision about anything, she can let you know about that. If she was the primary, so that would be good to know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Everybody looks so serious. Smile, people. Smile. We're into July.
Karen, don't go away.
Okay. Anybody else need me for anything? We're good.
We're good.
You can hang on just a second too, Brent. I want to talk to both of you.
Bye.
Okay. Blessings. Be well.
Bye, everybody. Next month.
Okay.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks for coming, Erin. Thanks for being here, everybody.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks, Brent.
Bye, everybody.
Okay. Bye, Lawrence. Yeah. Bye, y'all. Lawrence, okay, are you Karen. Still? Is Lawrence still there?
Yeah, Lawrence is still there.
Can you unhook his mic? He's stifled.
Yes, I can unhook his mic. There you go. He can talk to you now.
And it's still showing he's muted.
Well, I'm trying to unmute him. Come on, Lawrence.
Maybe he's muted himself.
I don't know.
Oh, well. Lawrence, I don't
Sometimes
know if you can
he's
hear
hard to sense. Unmute oh, because
there it goes.
There he is. Go ahead, Lawrence.
Oh, no, I had to step away.
That's okay. Oh, no problem. Lawrence, we have to write up how HMR works. It's time. We have to articulate how this is all working. You must have figured it out by now, right?
I have a basic idea.
Okay. Basic ideas are a good start. We want to resume the research next year. I don't think we're going to get to it in the fall. I think it's just going to be too difficult. Oh, there you are. Look at your happy self. Okay, cool. The bearded
I've
wonder.
I've never seen Lawrence. Hello, Lawrence.
Hello.
I've never seen Lawrence. Oh.
I've never seen Lawrence.
Wow. No. Okay. Yeah, so yeah, we need to write this up and come up with our, you know, our theory behind HMR. Not theory, but our the practical things we can identify now about how it's working. So that would be great.
I have at least, you know, because the alpha theta, the fact that you're talking about the alpha theta is linked directly to the default mode network. And the other part of the brain that works. So you have the executive function and then there's the default mode network. So once you get into the alpha theta, you've essentially turned off the executive and then you've turned on the default mode network. And that part of the brain is probably the part of the brain that's actually doing all the work in HMR or most of it.
Good to know. Well, that's what we want to articulate. So if you want to start writing that up for me, that would be great. How HMR is functioning. And because we need to be publishing and include some material and research about how, you know, if you need more access to any of the data stuff, let me know. We're starting to analyze some of the accumulated data in the software with colors and numbers, but I think we didn't do pain scales for a lot of it. So that's unfortunate, but you know, anyway. Keep that in mind. We'll have a, before the end of the year, we'll have a research committee meeting and we'll revamp. We have some money in the account. I don't know how much we have. We have several thousand. I don't know if it's at 10,000 yet, but we should be getting up there somewhere. And so we'll have enough, and I'll throw some more money in next year when more private clients start flying in and stuff like that. And we have some people that every time they come in, they give us money for the charity. So that's been good. Mm-hmm. We will look at that, and we will resume. Certainly, I think when it's safe enough to fly and be around, we'll do some more research work.
Did you want to also include the, to measure your sympathetic nervous system change? I forgot what the machine was. I sent you something about it. I know that it would include changes of the protocol, but it might be interesting to show how the heart rate variability changes from before you do it and after you do it. And that, then you demonstrate that it's not just working on a brain level, it's also working on an autonomic nervous system level.
Actually, my request to Dr. Kowal was, when we did the biofeedback measurements in 2000, mm-hmm. we had heart rate variability and galvanic skin response along with the brainwave measurements. And now the damn QEGs, pardon my English, they don't do the galvanic skin response without a special additional app, and they're not doing the heart rate variability, the monitor. And so I'm like, well, this is supposed to be high technology, and we've lost two of our most noticeable indicators, you know. In fact, the exciting part was both the galvanic skin response and the heart rate variability in our initial measurements spiked at almost the same moment. It was visible. Researchers went crazy when they saw it. They're like, oh my God, look, you have both galvanic skin response and heart rate variability that are identically peaking at the same moment, you know, it looks like in the chart and the diagrams and the measurements. So you are right about that. I told Jim I'll pay for it. We'll add the component. Let me know what else it costs us, but we will add the galvanic skin response and heart rate variability, you know, to the equipment. But I don't have that set up here right now.
So I had said to you, I will donate the equipment for the heart rate variability. So you let me know when you're ready for that.
All right. So I think there is an app that can be added to the regular QEG machine. Is that kind of what you're talking about, the piece that's added, or is it a separate machine you're talking about?
I think it may be a separate machine, but it is considered like a research level accepted machine.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'm wondering why we can't go on and do that. You know, could you get that machine in your office, and when you're working with people, go on and do the heart rate variability part?
It requires what? Just like a monitor over the heart here, a couple of places in the heart, or where do you, you know, how you measure?
I'd have to go back and actually look at that. But you would, I think there's a baseline. You do a setup as a baseline to show the heart rate variability before, and then you can monitor during. And then, but you really, the heart rate variability doesn't really matter as much during the, while you're going through the memories. You kind of want to show before and after,
right,
that there should be increased heart rate variability after you've done the treatment. And that would demonstrate that the autonomic nervous system has kind of reset itself. It's become more responsive, more dynamic, and is not as much shut down, or is not as much in a high excited state as a baseline. Cool. And that would then demonstrate that your HMR is functioning on a, not just on a brain remodeling level, but it's also working on an autonomic system level.
Well, that's something we could do with sit down and talk with them, you know, like do a triple blind study kind of a thing, you know, I don't know what we do. Have them sing for one therapy session. Have them do a talk therapy for one session and do HMR from the third kind of situation. But do heart rate variability with all of those. That would be pretty easy to measure, actually. We have the machine. And then do the comparison studies. What are the differences that we're seeing in random?
Actually, Lawrence, subjects? Aren't you talking about running the heart rate variability on the person before we start an HMR session?
Yeah. Before, and after,
see what the difference is before the session and after the session. And you do that in the same session?
We did that in 2000 with a subject as the initial test. And there it is right there.
Yeah.
And that's where you see the memory chart there. Lawrence, you see where the memories peak, the first one. The second one was not a heart racer. It was like a death of somebody. It was kind of sad. The third one was more, the first one, the third one, and the fourth one, kind of with a double peak, were very visceral, were physically traumatic events. I think the second one was just a sadness about somebody passing away or something. So it didn't get a heart rate. You know, it wasn't something that caused an adrenaline rush, but the other memories all did that adrenaline spike. And so the heart and the galvanic skin response were freaking out.
Like, that looks to me, I'd have to look at it, Karen, more exact, but that looks more as a heart rate by itself. Heart rate variability is the dynamic change on a beat-to-beat basis. So there are literally microsecond changes.
I don't know if they had that available back then, you know, in 2000 when we did it. That wasn't available in the research tools. But yeah, so that would be great. I think what you're talking is much more detailed. It would be very interesting. So let's do it. Let's do it.
From what I'm reading, am I right, Lawrence? That can be as exciting research-wise as doing anything else, and it doesn't have to be done with the QEEGs.
Correct. Because it's measuring something completely different. It's measuring your autonomic nervous system. Mm-hmm. It's measuring the, in particular, more of the sympathetic nervous system rather than the parasympathetic nervous system.
Correct.
And that would be more somebody who has a fight flight response. And I could almost list, these are the symptoms kind of to look for. So if a person has, let's say, constipation, and they're coming in with a symptom, they have a chronic constipation, they have, I'm trying to think of other good, but as opposed to a irritable bowel syndrome is more of a parasympathetic based disease. So if you divide it up it may work for the parasympathetics as well, but you would look more for something that's an anger issue, anxiety, people with anxiety, that's where you have, again, that's the sympathetics that are turned on. And if the sympathetics are turned on with anxiety and the anxiety dissipates, then a demonstration that it's on a neurological level that it's affected would be with the heart rate variability changing.
Mm-hmm. Could that be hot? Could that line up with musculoskeletal pain, Lawrence?
It can. There is I saw it maybe about a year or two ago. There is a newer theory, for example, for fibromyalgia, that it's due to the sympathetic nerves going to the small blood vessels. And since it's a random distribution, that's why nobody can get a exact picture. And you can't really, and no opioids will work. So in anything that is sympathetic mediated, you will not have, opioids will not work because it's not the right receptor. With regards to, that would be like a chronic regional pain syndrome.
Yep. I was thinking of fibromyalgia. As a massage therapist, I used to treat people who had that, and without knowing what you're talking about, there was a way to deal with fibromyalgia that was addressing, I later learned, the sympathetic system as opposed to the parasympathetic system. And you could relieve their pain if you could deal with that with some of the techniques we used. Not consistently, we couldn't do it consistently. And I'm now believe it might've been memory based, you know, because we were using simply a physical modality to address pain as opposed to could it have a memory component to it. But it would be interesting to test what you're talking about with some of those people.
Definitely. What does the machine run, Lawrence? Do you know what it runs in general? Is there a price range?
I think there was a consumer version for like $200 or $300, and then there was a more of a research version for $500.
Oh, I could buy that. That would be easy to work with. That would be great. I might even be able to talk Miraval into some of that. But anyway, for now, we're not touching. I'm touching. People will start flying into work with me beginning probably September. And I can do intensive work with people with that and be able to do that. So if you have a recommendation as the research version that we might want to use, let me know.
I sent you one. I'm just looking up July 5th, 2017. If you go look at that, let me see if I can also copy the.
I can find it. I will have that email.
I've seen a list of all those sympathetic nervous system symptoms you're talking about, like constipation.
Uh-huh.
I think it's in Bessel's book. But he lists if they're the following symptoms, then it's a sympathetic nervous system problem. And so, Brent, you could use that list to decide which clients would be most likely affected by HMR and the heart rate variability.
So I sent a link. I just put a link up in the chat section. I'd look in one of more of my physiology books to start with in terms of the sympathetics, or find something online just to get a more scientific base, like, you know, a more original source for that. Mm-hmm. But it would be like, even like a dry mouth is a sympathetic, it can be a sympathetic symptom. Anything that you would think, what do you need in order to have to go and fight or flee, is all of the parts of the body that are unnecessary during a fight, they get turned off, and all the parts of the body that are necessary get blood essentially shunted to them. That's what the body does. And in a parasympathetic, all the parts of the body that need to, for growth, for digestion, for that are not going to be fighting, but are more of helping get the body relaxed, those are where the blood gets shunted to. And that's how you kind of have, that's the basics of it. But in the polyvagal theory, that then goes into, and that's really part of the basis to, I think, a lot of the, what I call them non-mainstream psychotherapies, of the basis for their functioning is the polyvagal theory, saying, we are not only just talking about the brain, we're also working on the autonomic nervous system.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah, cool. Well, let's work on that and look at what we need to do in terms of instrumentation and measurements, and maybe come up with a look at the instruments and a protocol about how we can implement that within the next few months would be great. We can start doing some of our own measurements with that, but, mm-hmm. you know. Testing
it out, okay.
Sort of get the waters.
Yeah. Karen, I have an update for you. I have not forgotten you in the what a statistics I've been trying. One, I needed to take a break from my doggies. I needed to stop caring for animals, so I just kind of shut myself down for a week. But I ran into this, and I was talking to Brent earlier. When I went to look at the back end of the software, we look at...
Thanks, Lawrence.
Okay, bye. Thank you. I got to go.
Thank you.
Okay. When we record in the software, you don't see it when you're looking at the list of body positions, but there is right and left side, there is regional, and then there are site specific. So when you go in and you're looking at, when I went and I took abandoned is one of the things, and I started looking at, and it's a number, each of those points are numbers. I started looking at him. I went, okay, wait a minute. I'm looking at this one table and there are numbers over here in these memories that are not in this table. And that's when I started to piece together, okay, I'm going to have to make one very large table that includes right, left, regional, and site specific. And then when we get through with this data, what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to, and I'm trying to start doing this, collect. In other words, if it's right deltoid, that also could be a region. The word abandoned could be, dependent on the person putting the information in, could be the right deltoid or it could be the right shoulder. And both of those are kind of in the area. So when I finish with this, I think we're going to have to take this and determine, are we going to go up to the regions, up to that regional level, to say, okay, abandonment issues tend to collect, we see statistically more of them in this area, or are we going to go site specific?
Right.
Meaning, and that's going to be you guys' call. My hunch is, Brent, that the regional areas are going to show more of a statistical evidence than site specific. In other words, we could have, you know, four people with the right deltoid, four people with the right clavicle, but they'd all be that shoulder area if we put them together under the region as opposed to the site specific muscle or whatever. It's up to you, because I'm going to bring the information out as site specific and then correlated into the region as well.
I think that's good. I think it's like we've done before. And I've spent a lot of time researching online what are those names, you know, what are those names? And thinking you might want to combine them initially, but I think after talking with Brent, we don't want you to combine anything.
You want to look at the data in raw.
Right. And then we can look at the data raw and say, well, that means something if we summarize it this way. You know, it means something individually, definitely, but it also can mean something to give to other people if we can combine it in some manner.
Right.
Well, the one thing you're going to have to take into account is that depending, and this could have happened even with Brent over the years, depending on what that client was saying to him, he might have chosen shoulder region, or the client may have specifically pinpointed a site. So you could be looking at, you know, data where you're going to have to try to find a way to marry those two activities together for the same encoding word. Because I finally got all of the encoding down to where I can look at them.
What's going to end up happening is there will be like the themes, like
right
relationships, responsibility will be in the shoulder and rotator cuff. But the rotator cuff will also have, as you pin it down, a more specific trauma meaning for some people, or the majority of people actually. It's in the right rotator cuff. It's a very specific trauma, usually with a specific individual, a male or female, depending on which rotator cuff. That's the other side. Is it right side or left sided? And is the client right-handed or left-handed? We didn't always record that in the software. But it doesn't matter. If the majority of people, if their mother was more, it's not even male or female.
Right.
If the mother was more aggressive, she's on the right side, if they're right-handed. If the dad was more aggressive, on the left side. So it's going to be interesting to see what the correlations are, but we're going to see relationships between the trauma pattern and the site location. We know that. I know I've seen it over and over, like the knees, teenage years, chronologies relating to some things. I would be interested in seeing if we get correlations between what I've seen and the reported chronologies down my map that I already came up with.
Let me ask you a question right now. What do you think is the statistic? What would you say in your experience if someone is reporting that they're encoding emotion or their T1 emotion or moment, whatever, is abandonment or abandoned, how often do they say it, that the metaphor is in their eyes?
Well, see, that's the difference. You're not going to be able to do that, because for the person that had their first trauma coming out of the womb that was kind of allergic to the mother's milk, and then our mother's milk dried up and there wasn't any mother's milk, it's in their stomach.
Okay, but I will tell you,
if they're not there emotionally there for them, it's going to be in a lot of abandonments in the heart area.
And that's what I'm about to tell you.
Predominant sites would be eyes, heart, and stomach.
Nope.
Yep.
You'd be surprised. Nope. That's what I would have told you, that the most of the time, that eyes would be there a lot of times. Mm-hmm. Statistically, eyes don't tend to fall into the group.
Eyes are not the coolness.
Right. It's the heart. You feel abandonment in the heart.
Yeah, exactly.
The stomach, for some reason, the stomach area is coming up.
You exist, therefore you are. If you're not fed, you feel abandoned.
Right.
It's easy.
And the back.
Stomach and heart, they're going to compete for control, both stomach and the heart.
Back is lack of support.
Spine is core support in life. The whole half of that is abandonment. You can have back pain.
if I'm right, I'd have to go back and check because I haven't looked at
it. Now, abandonment would probably be lower back.
Abandonment.
Lower and mid back, but mostly lower back for abandonment, not upper back.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And what's interesting is you've got one in there with its abandonment, stabbing. There's a line, there's a one, so a number of them that are abandonment. Because you'll often have three or four words, and I was one that was, and this is the one I found really interesting. I got a few of these abandonment stabbing ones, and what was interesting, they were dead center in the middle of the back.
Both parents, like neither one.
So
something happened.
You will see some stuff, but I wanted you to know, Karen, that when I started into this, I went, okay, I got to figure out these tables and how they relate. And I took a stab and thought I knew what they did. And Brent confirmed for me today, yes, when they put those together. So now I've got to go back and create this overall right-left region and then site-specific so that I can translate those numbers. Because when it goes into the software, it's just a number because that's how they put it on the body. It's a point. And it's just a number. And I have to reference that out to a word so it translates for you guys. And what you need to know, is it right, left, site, is it region or is it site specific? Because sometimes all that's happening with the clients, they're just telling you a region. They're not getting site specific. That's what
Well, Brent some people, here's the thing. Some people are way more in touch with their bodies than other people are.
Right.
So they don't have the language of anatomy that you have. Or, you know, like,
it's and that's
the,
what,
my temporal lobe, my head hurts. Is it inside or out? Is it on the right or the left? I think it's on the right more than the left. Okay. So you're going to get, you know, vague data from some people.
Okay. So what I'm going to tell you from what I've observed is where you two are going to fall out. And I'm just going to tell you, I think, is that you're going to have the best data, the most usable data is going to be when you go roll everything up to the region. Mm-hmm. In other words, the shoulder, the heart, the stomach, as opposed to specific. Now, Brent, I do know, and it's the software isn't capturing all of that nuance of, you know, the left side of the heart, the right side of the heart. Some of it's getting captured there, but it's not as much, it's not as discreet as what you are probably recording as the therapist in your notes. Specifically to the software, it's not that discreet. You have a better, like if you're noting stuff, then that's more in your observation or what they tell you, that sort of thing. But I am seeing just from the first few passes I've done, especially when I go region, I begin to see grouping of numbers, all right? But I'm not going to do that. I'm going to give it to you in raw data, and then I will also give you a regional one. You can look at the raw data, and then you can see what happens when you go regional.
Oh, yay, if you can give me a regional. And I expect we may have some individual case studies come from this, like physical therapist and the way they describe it. I think that would be really fascinating as well. We'll pull out individual clients and show how specific.
Well, you got to remember, I am not including any personal data.
Right.
What you're gonna, I am simply looking, because I wanted this to be as blind as I could make it.
Right.
I literally am not even looking at client IDs with this. I am simply in the memory chart, in the memory tables, and looking at memories themselves. So I don't know whether I'm looking at a man, a woman, a child, an adult, or whatever. I'm just looking at raw data.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can go back because when I dump the data, I do have that information tied with these memories. We can go back and do that at some point. But for this first pass, I'm just taking a broad swipe at just raw data.
I think that's excellent. I think the raw data is going to lead us to some really fascinating stuff, and I don't know what that's going to be.
Nope. No. All right. That sounds good. Yay.
All right. So now that I finally got to that point, it's easier for me to crunch these things, hopefully. And now that I'm back online working again, maybe I can get some stuff done in the next couple of weeks. You know, so you can get some.
Yeah.
I'll be cussing you with that much raw data, but I'm ready for it.
Yep. It's not as much as you think it is. It's really when you, because we're not going to go for every encoding word. You would not believe just going in and taking the field that is called encoding level, which is the T1 thing, and separating out, like if you'd chosen four words, because a lot of times they give you four words.
Emotion.
So what I did is I split that into columns so that I could just deal with one encoding word at a time. And that was about 8 hours of work just to separate all, because there's 50,000, there's a bunch of memories in there, you know, and I did.
What is our memory total? Do you know what our memory total in the software?
No, not all. I'd have to go look. What I did is I dumped it all out, the entire memory table out to an Excel spreadsheet I can work with on my computer. So I have it in a mark in time, you know, so it's not got the most recent data. And then I started crunching things, and in that process, I cleaned up a lot of what looked like sloppy records. They're just not, they look like somebody either didn't get it in right, or I'm not even sure what was going on. So I eliminated all of that noise out to get down to a body of statistics that, which is still big enough to make some assumptions from.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, this isn't going to lead you to the kind of stuff that Lawrence is talking about. What this is going to lead you to is more of, can you actually take the software, the information coming out of the software, and validate that the software statistically lines up with what you, the therapist, intuitively know from experience, that abandonment tends to end up in these areas of the body. This is what you believe. Well, then yes, I can tell you, yes, it does, because here's the statistical evidence where you recorded memories, and that's where the client told you that the metaphor was. And I don't know whether that's valuable or not, but it definitely reinforces some of the, does the software reflect what the therapist is intuitively believing about the client? And there may be some things that can be further investigated based on that. If we look at the people who encode sexually abused and it all tends to end up in these body areas, then we might want to go grab those memories and look further into those memories and see what other things we find about that. And I'm only looking at level ones. I'm not touching level two at all, because that's going to be much harder statistically. We have to grab a bunch of tables to get that information, Brent, because the minute we do a level two, that's when we pick up the reparenting tables and the all in the level two.
Not necessarily. The reparenting tables are just solution addition mechanisms.
Now, there's a table for level two. What is that called? I can't think of it right now, but it's where you pile up, and there's another, when we built the software, because you know how when you do level two, it pops up a new screen?
Yeah.
All right, there's another, that screen has a table. And in order to work the level two memories, we've got to look at the data in that table and what they record when they say it's a level two, and what happens over in that table. And then I don't really know, you're going to have to help me figure out how I tie that back to where you started with the metaphor. Does that make sense? In other words, usually that memory will go along. If in the table, there's some information about a metaphor starting, and all of a sudden, when I look at the level, it's getting marked as a level two. So I know as a therapist, whatever they were working on, you figured out that it was in more than, it wasn't a single incident, and it became a level two memory at that point. Tying all that together is something I'm going to have to sit with you, and we're going to have to map that out.
Yeah, that would be a little trickier, because sometimes the level two metaphor, I didn't even enter the description of, I just hit enter sub-memory, did it as a level two, and we didn't even define the metaphor, because it's the same metaphor coming off the level one.
Right.
The earlier metaphor. So the data for the level two would be, if it's not spoken, it's probably coming from the previous metaphor.
Right. And what we have to figure out is that when we go look at those level twos, what triggered back in the software, and it usually is that you show it as a sub memory and all that kind of stuff, and then it picks, triggers out.
Level two by itself is not complicated. I mean, it's just
it's not.
It's more than two memories with the same metaphor. More than two memories occurring under the same metaphor. So it's a pattern of some sort. It's just a
pattern. Do you care whether or not it's related back to the beginning memory? Do you want to know that information? Or do you just want to look at level two memories as an entity?
Not necessarily.
Okay. Think about it.
A level two is may be related to the first, and it may not be related to the first.
Okay. If it's not, then we don't need to, then there's no reason to try to tie them together. We can just look at level
two. No, I think that would be way too complicated. But
okay.
Level two, some people do only level twos. They don't even do level ones in the whole session.
Okay.
The entire session is level two. A level two is just there are times when it does come off. The way you link it, I'll tell you how you link it. The way you link it is the metaphor will be the same for the level two. If it's a, like, oh, I'm sexually abused at 5. Oh, I'm sexually abused at 7. Oh, let's do a level two on that, because at 5, it's, oh yeah, you abuse me all the time between 3 and 13. Okay, so level two incorporates the first one, the second one, but it actually is the whole pattern of abuse. But you could deal with them individually, and you could deal with level two. It depends how I mapped it. Most of the time, it's going to be a level one, and then it's like suddenly it'll be a diagonal line, like a level two.
Yep.
We can invite all the kids to MLS. How many are there? 24 of them? Like, oh my God, okay. That's why we're doing a level two. But the pain is going to be off the original pain site or sites where the level one occurred. You know, you have level twos coming off of level twos too. Sometimes patterns are interrupted by bigger patterns.
Do they normally?
Level two, it'll usually have its own metaphor though. Most level twos should have their own metaphor.
Okay.
If it's not stated, it either came up so fast I didn't have time to enter it, to put it in, to follow it, or it's pretty much off the first, ultimately it owes its existence to the first metaphor anyway.
Okay.
So you could, from a therapeutic standpoint, say that all level twos, unless they're designated with their own specific metaphor, are going to be outgrowths of the previous metaphor.
Okay, well see, that'll be something we can go look at. The other thing is, do level twos normally have a body location?
Yeah, so to the extent that there's, that's a good question, because level twos can cover probably multiple. If I don't put in a body site in, it's probably because it was amorphous and non-specific.
Okay. See, that's another, I mean, that's not what I'm working on right now, but that's a whole
other. Or we got so busy to recording the level two date, I just forgot to go back. Right. Sometimes I just forget to go back and put in the body site. But you could sometimes, if it is off a level one, if it is a two off a level one, you could use the level one reference.
Right. And that'll be some of the things, because I can actually look at the level two table and reference back to the memory that it triggered off of normally.
But level twos can have 322 ego states involved, at which point it would probably be all over the body. So there's not going to be a specific site for it. It covers many, many different sites sometimes, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let me take this first pass at just because what I'm doing right now is a real high level, just let's look at the T1 moment and what was the location on the body?
Interesting to just see how many memories we've done in the software since we started it. So eventually give me a number of what's kind of clean, semi-clean or whatever.
Okay.
Get some idea about that.
Yeah, if you can give us the dates you're including, the dates of software capture that you're including, number of clients, total number of level one memories.
I can give you total number of level one memories. I can give you dates. I'm not including the clients. Because, I take that back. Let me go look at the table. I may have a client ID. If that's so, I can count them. Let me go look and see. I know I have a session ID, but let me see if I have a client ID in the table. If I do, then I can count the number of unique numbers, and that will give me number of clients.
Or even number of sessions.
I can give you sessions.
Yeah, either, you know, we love both at some point, including level two, but just something to say, we're looking at this and here's the definition of what that is.
Well, and then my recommendation is when I make this first pass, I'll give you a beginning and ending date to the rough data I have, and then I think you guys should pick from here to here, and I'll run the numbers again. In other words, I'll eliminate between, we may not want to do the first 6 months in the software because that was so much testing. And, you know, through, and you guys give me a range of date, you know, and then we'll, I'll carve that data, rerun the algorithms that pull out all the, that do the counts and on the body locations. And then we have a definitive date range. And if possible, I can count up the session numbers and I can count up the clients.
I mean, they're going to have to go to you, or you're going to have to come here for us to be able to look at that probably. Maybe all three of us need to get together in Houston with you. That might be.
Well, I should be able to do it across a Zoom meeting. When I get it all together, I'm going to be able to show it to you. You know.
It's going to be a matter of looking at the time period when it started and.
I can show you that because it's all in an Excel spreadsheet.
I think it was working pretty well from the beginning. I don't think we have.
No. The first. The first 200 to 400 records are some of the jumbled records. I can tell a lot of them are Joel and all that kind of stuff, and I don't want there. That's test data.
See, well, I mean, we were testing it, so I put in crappy records and they made up names, and you'll see the stupid
they were.
Ones, so that can all be that can all be taken out, right?
That's what I did, is pull out some of that garbage in that beginning part, and then. And start the at a certain date when I thought I started to see what looked like clean data, which is why I'm saying we need to define, if you're ever going to talk to somebody about this, it needs to be from this date to that date, the records in the software.
Right. Well, we'll just clean it up. That'd be better safe than sorry. Eliminate some of the extra crazy stuff at the beginning and from where it was really pretty functional. So.
Well, if I get
okay,
there.
Okay. Well, thank you for all those hours. Well, I have to buy you a puppy for all that.
No. I have plenty of
dogs. You don't want a doggy. You need a doggy to keep you company while you're working on the computer.
Grant, I don't need any more doggies. Let me.
You don't need any more cat? How about a big cat? A Maine Coon cat. I'll get you a Maine Coon cat.
Let me tell you something that I will tell the two of you real quick. One of the things that when I finally said I cannot do this anymore, I've had it. One of the statements that my partners said to me, one of them said, you know, you need to understand you're not alone in this. Mm-hmm. And I stopped and I went, yeah, I am alone. I said, neither one of you, my partners are not the medical side of this. I said, y'all don't make these medical decisions. You don't get up, go in the morning and hope that you make the right decision that won't cost a dog its life that day. Mm-hmm. I said, one of the things I'm having to deal with is that since we started, I have bagged up and done the disposal for every dog we've lost. And many of them, I have been present to their passing. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know,
you might be too kind-hearted for this stuff. I don't know.
No, you know,
I'm not.
But what I do know is that you can't do that over and over again without eventually having to step back and say,
right, you're going to get fried. Yeah,
that cost, you know, and
you're going to have to turn it over eventually. Mm-hmm.
Well, you should see, because I put out to the universe, I said, if you want this business to succeed, you better start showing up some medical people equally qualified to me or better. Well, they're coming. Okay. You know, and that's what I need, is that there are people who can say, I've got it, Jeanette, I can make the decisions and I don't have to carry that weight. And the reason I knew I was there was I was in the office with Dr. May, who is the veterinarian that is our volunteer veterinarian. And he has 50 acres of property north of Houston that, and he, every time he gets a chance, that's where he heads. And I was in there with a dog that we were putting an IV in and putting in isolation. And he was talking about it. And I said, you know, all I really want right now is a corner of your property where nobody can find me with a cell phone. Nobody knows I'm there. I just want to go sit for a period of time. And he was on the microscope and he looks over at me and he said, I told you nobody can do this 7 days a week and you're reaching your end. And I went, laughed and I said, how do you know that? And he said, because every time I go to the property, there's a corner I go sit in where nobody knows where I am. The cell phones cannot reach me. He says, none of y'all can get to me. He says, that's the only place I put it all down. And I went, okay, fair enough. You know, so you don't, that is one of the things I've come to understand about doing this. I can't do this for a lot of years. And I told everybody from the beginning, at 67 years of age, I cannot do this for the next 10 years. I just don't have that age. But I also realize that it is wonderful when the dogs live. And that's what most of my team is in the, right. Yay, post on Facebook, all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It is those quiet moments in the middle of the night or early in the morning or whatever, when you realize they're not going to make it. And there is not anything you can do other than make sure they don't suffer through it. That, and you just wonder, did I make the right decisions and all that kind of stuff? And I thought, oh Lord, I should call Brent and tell him I'm going to have to go come do HMR on, you know, have I done what
I need eventually to put something on the problem. My condo's paid off before too long, a couple of months. So I'll have to start looking at something in New Mexico. So maybe we'll have our little hideaway with off the grid with just no power except solar and wind and your own pump, and government can't reach you.
You know,
nobody knows you're there. Dirt roads to get out there.
I'm not sure I could climb all of that anymore.
You don't have to climb, you drive it.
You can drive up to your property. Last time I was up there, we had to walk back in.
No, you can drive. It's a drive, sort of drive. Okay. By the time we get up there, we'll make a drive, you know, so that's the next step. So I'm talking to my niece. I said, you know, hey, if this happens, I'll leave you the property if you want to build the house. I mean, she's a lawyer. She's got a husband that's a podiatrist. Yeah. They got money, so I said, I already paid for the land. That's $200,000 in property. I said, if you want to put a structure up there, we can certainly go from there. If I find a group of investors that want to have rights to it after I'm gone or whatever, I said, we can figure something out. Sue's house is available down the street from mine. Sue's house and her two lots are available. I found out, I didn't realize Jane Weingart had died in 2009, who owns the two lots next to me across. So I don't know what's happened to that property. Somebody must be paying the taxes on it.
Wow.
So I could go from, you know, anyway, we'll just see how the money comes in, how it flows, because it's crazy time right now with the COVID thing. But I have new clients coming in every week to make ends meet. We're hanging everything. All my debt, in the COVID year, I'll be debt free, which is kind of a crazy ass thing, you know, but and everybody's flailing and freaking. I have job security, and if Biden gets elected, as I hope he will, then things will start improving somewhat. The astrologer says this does not stabilize financially until March of 2021.
Oh, I know that's true.
So that's looking like when vaccine or something or the economy and people de-escalate, things start calming down somewhat.
No, I guarantee you Biden will be sworn in on January, and it'll take him about 60 days to reach out with his people and begin to, although I guarantee you on election day that night, just like 4 years ago, there was a whole portion of our country that probably dropped to their knees and cried like I did when I realized what was happening to us. I think you're going to see a whole portion of our country take the first deep breath they have taken in 4 years.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about that.
You know,
it's been terribly stressful for me dealing with these people and all their emotions. And wanting to move to Canada and all freaked out. And everybody's stressed out. And I have crazy clients that love Trump. I have to deal with these people every day.
Yeah.
And they're insane. They believe what they clearly believe what they want to believe. And some of them are very uneducated and mentally limited. And I can see how he got to them. And God and guns, that was basically the Republican motto to win elections. If you can go for an abortion issue, look conservative, and get guns, you have a huge percentage of the uneducated population. And
Brent,
they did to the 62%. That's how they got it.
I would be willing to bet you, if you dig a little bit, what you're going to find out is underneath all of that, and this is just me, is that you're dealing with, and it's not so much specific, but it's an energy. It's what I call the white male energy of the United States, the privileged white male energy that knew it was dying. And I used to hear it.
Actually, yeah, I think there's a part of that, and that is the upper 10-12%
yep.
of the Republicans that are in the think they're in the elite Ivy League. But here's the thing. Years ago, decades ago, it flipped. It used to be the blue collar or the Democrats. And now it's happening in all the urban centers. The educated are voting Democrat. And the Republicans saw that and said, we have to get the inner uneducated rural America to vote the way we want. And they did God and guns. And when they did that and went just blind, fundamental, Christian, Trump's not Christian. Trump's like an atheist, you know, financial maniac. So anyway, he runs around churches and holds the Bible and arrests people and whatever does he wants to do. But it's God and guns. But if you say abortion, you already have a guaranteed 30 to 40 conservative percent right there. Mm-hmm. You throw in the guns, you got the other 20% that's kind of floundering. But that is tied into white male power, supremacist, God and guns. So between those two, even though they're no longer the elite educated, you know, they're no longer the predominant educated, you know, moneyed populations. That's a very small percentage that's controlling the other 52%
right.
of the vote, except now he's pissed everybody off at this point, which is great. He's pissed off the Christians. He's pissed off, you know, minorities. He's upset the blacks, which a lot of them did have the gun, you know, kind of thing. But anyway, there's just huge populations that he's messed with. So hopefully this will all be done and we can take a breath. I will be a lot more relaxed. But my crazy Jewish clients, I just watched them like, oh, Trump's so wonderful what he's done for our country with finances. And I'm like, obviously she only listens to her fundamentalist Christian station. She only listens to the conservative political reviews. She's not noticing what's happened. And her mother was Trump. Her mother was one of the worst narcissists I've ever come across. And she can't see it. She's like married to her narcissist, you know, and has no idea that she's done it. So it's just bizarre how people get addicted to their own belief systems, you know?
Well, I am utterly convinced that the reason why Joe Biden is in the position he's in is it was going to take Grandpa to help us get out of this.
Well, you know, what's interesting is you understand that they thought Biden had they thought Biden was getting dementia, but he doesn't have dementia. Trump's trying to get everybody to listen to his speeches that he has dementia. He doesn't have dementia. He had a speech impediment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he does.
So he says words. He uses words that were a little off synonym sometimes.
Yes.
But he's a very compassionate person. He's had a terrible amount of trauma in his life. So he's very, very kind and compassionate. So
he's also smart as a whip, and most people don't realize that. One of the things that most people didn't realize was that Barack Obama, and I read an article years ago about this, Barack Obama knew about his speech impediment. So Barack Obama, when they would be talking together, Obama would, when he would hit that speech impediment, Obama would put a word in and it would be the word Biden needed, and then he'd move on because they were so in sync as a team together. He knew that, and Obama suffered from being too intellectual. He was so brilliant that he could get up and he said, so Biden would play the crazy Joe so that it balanced out. Obama didn't seem like too much of what they call a professor type and all that kind of stuff. So together they always presented it very, very well because they balanced the two of them out. This is somebody who was talking about why they were the absolute perfect fit together as a president and a vice president, because where Obama was strong, Biden was weak, and where weak, Biden was strong, you know. But I've told everybody, I said, Grandpa is going to have to help all of us calm down. And that's why he was the one that
It's not him. He probably won't make it through two terms. It's going to be his vice president that tells
him. I know. But I mean, 4 years of having that calm kind of, it's okay, folks. We're going to be fine.
That'd be good. Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, all right. I will keep working on
my love. All right. Thanks for all your hard work.
Bye, guys.
Okay, kiss the puppies for us.
I will. I'll kiss
okay. Thanks, bye. Karen. Okay.
Did you say she enjoyed it? She had to leave. So
bye.
Oh, good. She's a sweetheart. I'm glad she could join us. That's good. Yeah, I need to get on the bandwagon with the other group that you meet with. And also, Carrie needs to join the professional group. Mm-hmm. You may want to talk with her. I've asked her about being on the board. And so she's agreed to be willing to help us with the research. And she'd probably buy a heart machine, but if we could get a couple of those, you know, instruments that Lawrence is talking about and have her doing it, I'm doing it, you doing it, somebody, several of us working on this, we could really make some headway.
Well, Lawrence said he'd buy one too.
Yeah, exactly. So sounds good.
All right, I'm going to end the meeting.
Okay, bye y'all.
Bye.